Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
When people release the beast,
The Beast in Florida, a history of anti-black violence. Before I get to the overall purpose of what you were trying to do with the book, I wanted to focus on two words. The first one, beast. Why did you use the term beast in the title?
Because I wanted to connote to people that this thing had a presence. To me, the beast was the embodiment of white racial hatred and violence. That's what the beast was. That was what was allowed to prowl Florida virtually unchallenged for almost a century. It was a beast. It prowled. It sought people out. It victimized. It hid itself. It exerted tremendous power over people who were not even a part of it. So I saw all of that as the embodiment of what I conceive a beast to be. That's why I use that.
Release the beast, boys!
Okay, and this is in the subtitle, A History of Anti-Black Violence. What do you mean when you use the term anti-black?
I mean incidents in which white people set out intentionally to harm black people. And there were numerous incidents in which that happened in Florida, both legalized lynching and illegal lynching.
A grotesque menace to our just society who had the audacity to fight back.
Harry Moore began calling for an investigation of the shootings and for Sheriff McCall's ouster. Either the sheriff had shot two shackled men without cause, or he had shown recklessness and lack of forethought in transporting the men alone, as Moore saw it. Moore was doing what no colored men dared do in those days of Southern apartheid. He was standing up to the most powerful man in all of Lake County. He was attracting more attention from white supremacists who had resented him in the past, but were incensed at him now. He began getting death threats, and for the first time started carrying a gun with him on those lonely drives into the country. At the same time, unbeknownst to the local whites who deplored him, Moore was losing the support of NAACP headquarters in New York, an organization Moore had worked hard for, but which had its own national ambitions and was at that very moment seeking changes in the Florida operation Moore had built. Now that Florida was on the map, in civil rights terms, headquarters wanted to capitalize on the publicity of the Groveland case for its broader goals. It pushed for greater membership and for centralized county chapters, rather than the small colonies Moore had nurtured in places like Eustis. Headquarters could not have known the tensions on the ground in those isolated hamlets, or the fear in the people George tried to sign up in Eustis all those years ago, or recognized that country people couldn't risk being seen outside their homes at a county-wide NAACP meeting that would attract life-threatening attention. Not then, anyway. Moore and the NAACP remained at odds through the fall and into Thanksgiving of 1951. At a statewide meeting in early December, national officers finally managed enough votes to oust Moore, who had virtually given his life to the cause. His very strength was his undoing that night. The chapters in the small hamlets that were so loyal to him because they knew more than anyone the dangers he faced just getting there to see them, did not have the resources to send delegates to that meeting. Thus, the meeting was dominated by the delegates from Miami, Tallahassee, Jacksonville, big city groups that had their own politics and looked down upon the country teacher from a small town on the Mosquito Coast none of them had been to. Now, despite his hard work, Moore was no longer the head of the Florida NAACP. But the white supremacists he had challenged all those years wouldn't have known that. To them, he was still the NAACP's man on the ground and a target of their anger. Soon, white men from outside his county started asking people in town where that colored NAACP fellow lived. There was a mysterious break-in at the Moore's house, which sat isolated on a country road surrounded by orange groves. And then on Christmas night, 1951, the Moores' 25th wedding anniversary, a bomb exploded under the floorboards beneath their bed as they slept. It hurled furniture into the air and crushed the bed into a crater in the earth. The force of the blast could be heard the next town over. Harry and Harriet Moore suffered grave internal injuries. Relatives rushed them to the nearest hospital, some 35 miles away. But as was the common dilemma for colored patients in the South, they had to wait for the only colored doctor in town to get there to attend them. Harry T. Moore was dead by the time the colored doctor arrived. Harriet, saying she did not want to live without her husband, survived for 8 days before succumbing herself. The county, the state, and the FBI conducted a months-long investigation. It was determined that the Klan, specifically the Orlando Clavern, was behind the bombing. But as the investigation narrowed its focus, the Klansmen closed rank. At their meetings, they now began requiring everyone to recite the Klan Oath of Secrecy as the investigation closed in on them. The chief suspects all said they had been at a barbecue with 20 or 30 other members at the time of the attack, a convenient alibi for most anyone who would come under suspicion. Ultimately, no one was ever charged or spent a day in jail for the murder of Harry and Harriet Moore, considered by some the first casualties of the modern civil rights movement.
Context of White Supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, August 9th, 2016. So I have been told. No one punished. Surprise. The audio clips you heard at the beginning of the program I thought would provide some great history context, if you will. History, just the state of Florida. I think frequently when people think about racism, white supremacy, number one, this is a global system, but a lot of times it will get isolated to certain areas and just say, oh, Mississippi is really bad, or Alabama, oof, it's really bad there. Black people had a really tough time with white supremacy, racism in that area. Again, this is a global system. There is no sanctuary. And then if people are going to talk about regions that are notorious for white supremacy, somehow the state of Florida does not seem to pop up in that conversation. I would submit that is, wow, the atrocities against black people in that particular area, legion. Numerous examples. We're going to be talking about one specific incident today, but I thought at least the segments you heard at the beginning, the first voice, Dr. Marvin Dunn, I have tremendous respect for the history, the books that he's written. He was a guest on this program back in 2013. We discussed his book, The Beast in Florida, History of Anti-Black Violence. Astounding. And I think this would just be what we're going to talk about today would just be another chapter in the history of anti-black violence in the state of Florida. I even thought he probably would have some good information on this subject matter, Dr. Marvin Dunn. And then the second bit was a reading from one of the best books I have ever read, Isabel Wilkerson, the lovely Isabel Wilkerson, The Warmth of Other Suns, where she spends a considerable amount of time talking about the state of Florida and the bombing of Dr. Harry T. Moore and his wife, Harriet Moore. incredible incident does not get very much attention either when people talk about the history of black people who have sacrificed lots, including their lives, in fighting against white supremacy, racism. What we're going to be talking about today, continuing this theme of cruelty and white barbarism in the state of Florida, there's been a lot of attention focused recently on the Dozier Reform School in Florida. They've been doing exhumations and just unearthing bodies and some of the sadistic history of what took place at this school for young boys. I'm not sure if the racism aspect has been made abundantly clear when this has been reported on in mainstream outlets like NPR and many other sources. There's a new documentary film on this subject matter, but I think the book we're going to talk about today makes that explicitly clear that, yes, there were horrors, yes, there were white children here too, but this was a system for enslaving black boys, and she gives just a lot of tremendous detail in the book. The book we're talking about, Dark Days of Horror at Dozier, Rapes, Murders, Beatings, and Slavery. Incredible history documented in the text. Real pleasure to be able to speak about it today. Joining us, the guest, in addition to writing this book, she is a genealogist, historian, peonage researcher, and host of a television program. Real pleasure to have her on the broadcast this evening. Joining us live, our guest, Miss Antoinette Harrell. Miss Harrell, you're with us?
Yes, thank you for having me on your show, Gus. It's a pleasure.
Pleasure is ours. For our listeners, I'm sure some folks, this is their first time hearing about you and the fantastic work that you've done. Anything that you think would be important for listeners to know about you before we get started?
I think you said enough.
Outstanding. For folks who haven't seen a photograph, you're a black female, is that correct?
That's correct.
Right on. This program, Context of White Supremacy, I have unfortunately concluded that incidents like the Dozier School, this is a product of the system of racism, white supremacy. I use those two terms as synonyms. I use the same definition for both terms. That definition is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think that is an accurate definition? Do you think such a system exists?
Yes, I do. Certainly. There's a lot we can discuss on that subject, but certainly I'm in agreement.
Succinct, right on. I think it leads right into Dark Days of Horror at Dozier, the book we're going to go into in a little bit of detail. But just you have very respected work as a peonage researcher. Just can you explain to our listeners what that means exactly?
Yeah, the peonage means to be held in a system of involuntary servitude to work off a debt that possibly could have been occurred and possibly not. It depends on who was charging that person. And many times we think, when we hear the word sharecroppers, which is just another form of slavery, and people who are held in that system to pay off a debt, that's what peonage is. And so the people become defined as peons, held in a system of bondage, cannot leave the plantation or cannot leave the farm, or whatever location it is, until you pay off that debt and whatever amount that debt that the person say you owe them, or the company say you owe them.
And in your view, for people who might say, "Well, this is hyperbole," you know, you're exaggerating to say that this is just slavery continuing. You know, all that ended with the Civil War and Abraham Lincoln, the Emancipation Proclamation. Your response to why this is slavery. That is the accurate term to describe what this is.
Yeah, and we hear that all the time, is that, in, you know, slavery ended when Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. Well, sure, that's what the history books wanted you to know. That's what
I think Ms. Harrell may have gotten disconnected. I dialed her in. I'll See if I can get her back on my line. Just hang tight, folks. Could be a little interference. Oh, we do not have the same difficulties that we had yesterday. All right, dialing her back now.
Hi, this is Antoinette. Sorry, I can't take your call right now.
We'll give her a second or two before we try her again. Hopefully no major disturbances. Context of white supremacy. Thanks for your patience. I would again encourage folks are looking for any reading material, since people ask all the time about the reading list, which I'm trying to finish it out. If I can't do it by the end of the week, I'll just submit the list as is, and it's still a work in progress as I continue learning and reading more. But two submissions for sure: Dr. Marvin Dunn, The Beast in Florida, History of Anti-Black Violence. Amazing book, lots of great information, and we'll give a little bit more background information about what we're talking about today. Certainly, Isabel Wilkerson's The Warmth of Other Suns. Dr. Marvin Dunn was a guest on the program in 2013. We did The Warmth of Other Suns in the book club, took up a big chunk of our 2013. I think it's one of the longer books that we've done in the book club, but it was an amazing read, lots of focus on the state of Florida and many other areas, but it's incredibly well written, lots of great information, and it's a wonderful narrative. I mean, the focus on the three black people that she selected and just how this migration played out in their lives. It's just an amazing read. Would certainly encourage folks to check it out. One of my top five favorites, right up there with Medical Apartheid. Incredible read. Okay, we will try Ms. Harrell again, see if we've got things work out. Let's see. Hopefully we'll get her this time.
Hi, Gus. I lost you somehow.
Don't know what that happened. We tried to call you back once before, and it just went right to voicemail, so waited a second before we dialed back. All right, so we lost you. You were answering the people who might say that it is an exaggeration to describe peonage as slavery, you would say.
Absolutely. We hear this all the time, and it made me think about some of the interviews that I heard people who actually lived it and was held in that type of bondage couldn't leave. And there was a book that was called Worse Than Slavery, because in slavery, there was a reason to protect your chattel property. And so slavery was legal. But in this system, when slavery was supposed to be abolished, and if it was held in the conditions of slavery, that could have meant possibly jail time or indictments. And so it was a secret. And so hundreds of thousands of African-American people in this country did not see their freedom in 1863 or 1865. I met families that did not get out of slavery until 1962. I know some families now still on plantations, and I'm not talking about plantations where you go and you tour the plantation to go in the big house or go in the slave quarters. I'm talking about never left a plantation.
Wow. Wow. This, I'm fast-forwarding all the way to the end, basically, of Dark Days of Horror at Dozier. But I think this is, we reference this line on a regular basis. I think it's important at this moment. You write on page 184, many media publications published articles about, this is one of the folks that you talk about, Deidre Farmer Paleman.
Yeah.
You write, People magazine and other news articles covered her story. We were saying to the entire world, listen, people, slavery didn't end for hundreds of thousands of African Americans in 1863, and the world just didn't seem to care. Now I truly understand what Harriet Tubman meant by the statement, I freed 1,000 slaves. I could have freed 1,000 more if only they knew they were slaves. And even though I'm sure a lot of folks have heard that line before, even within this text, you have many incidents from some of the black children who were at Dozier who said the same thing, that they did not think of themselves as slaves at the time. But then looking back on it, they come to the same conclusion. That's exactly what it is. Can you comment?
Exactly. Yeah. I remember meeting some of the black men at Dozier and talking with them. And I really wanted to interview them, because when I read in one of the publications that was published by UFL, Florida University, they was talking about the system of penance. So I said, well, let me follow this trail. And that trail led me to do some research to find out what type of penance conditions was taking place on this at this reform school. Well, those little boys was out there cutting timber. They was growing all types of produce. They saw the trucks come in and take the produce. They was working. One day they would go to school. The next day they was in the field. But they never received that one penny, and their parents didn't receive any of the money as well. So these kids was actually used as modern-day slaves on the on Dozer, which was nothing but a state plantation for children. And so it was, you know, disguised. And so these little kids working from sunup to sundown, cutting timber, like I just said, chopping down sugarcane and working with livestock, and they never saw any of the money. But they saw the trucks come in and pick up the produce and take it out. And of course, we know that they were supplying the supermarkets and the grocery stores and whomever. Not to mention that there was also a sex farm that was there, where some of the boys was being hired out, I mean, given out to do day or weekend work, and they would be sexually abused. And in some cases, some of the children was being used for medical practices.
Wow. I just mentioned Harriet A. Washington, Medical Apartheid, while we were trying to ring you back. Extremely important book, and as I was reading, her book came to mind again. I want to ask about that as well. Just before we get into the book, I did want to ask, with the continuance of slavery, I think Douglas Blackman and his book Slavery by Another Name, he was a guest on this program after the book came out, but before that book was turned into a PBS documentary. His work seems similar to a lot of the research that you've done. Just what do you think of the scholarship that this white man, Douglas Blackman, has done?
Well, let me say this. I did this work long before Doug Blackman. I'm not going to take away from any of his work, but certainly it's very hard for African-American people to get any money to tell their story. That's the first thing. You just don't have those type of connections. And it makes me, it brings me to think about the woman, May Louise Miller, who was held as a slave. And all of these years, we would try to get people to have her to come on the radio talk shows, television interviews, but the doors slammed in her face. But the minute that Doug Blackman produced the book and then the film Slavery by Another Name, then, you know, people was calling me, oh, there's a documentary. You need to see this documentary. I didn't want to hear it because we had been out there going through the courthouses, going in the attics, meeting people. And you know, I come to learn why some of those people did not want to say anything. And at that point, I didn't blame them because who wanted to hear it? No one wanted, they didn't even care. Oh, she's lying. That could not have happened, you know. But let me just say this. But the minute a white man validated, that's it. It's validated now, you know, some truth to that now. And the documents in the National Archives didn't mean anything, you know. The testimonials from the people, records, tons of records, and no one still believed it, you know. It's very few people, very few people.
Wow. In your opinion, is that another aspect of racism, white supremacy, this white man coming out and doing this work and getting all this attention? Now people want to focus on it, where you had been doing painstaking research for years and nobody cared, and or suggesting that, oh, this is made up, you've lied or what have you. Is that another aspect?
Yeah. Well, it just sort of showed me at that time that even our own story, we don't even own our own stories. If you try to tell your experience, you just would not find the resources to do it. But the minute that a white person, so yes, it is that form of racism. You know, even when telling your own life experiences, you just face those oppositions. But I had to tell it, and it I wasn't going to stop telling it, whether there was any funds on the table to produce a film or write a book. I just had to tell it. And hopefully one day that somebody will say, okay, well, you know, let's look at this. And as there's too much evidence, there's evidence on top of evidence about Dozer Reform School. How I got involved with Dozer Reform School, let me just say that from the very beginning, clear that up. I heard about the school, but I only saw the white side of campus really getting the media attention. And the campus was segregated at this particular time with the men that I was talking to in the 50s and the 60s that when it was there. Well, no one was saying anything about the black side of campus. The media wasn't saying very much. You know, it was 85% of the stories was coming from the white boys that was on the white side of campus and nothing from the black boys on the black side of campus. And so I stepped in and said, I got to help these men tell their story. Somebody hear what they are saying. And so I met Pastor Johnny Gaddy. And when I think about the interviews and the time I spent with Pastor Gaddy, and when he talked about seeing the children's body parts in the, being fed to the hogs and the pigs, it was like, you know, did I believe him? Of course I believe him, because some of the worst things that I had read in documents from the National Archives, hearing interviews, the oral interviews from people in their 80s and their 90s, you know, just couldn't live with this stuff no more. They lived with this long enough, and it was enough. They wanted to tell somebody. And so, once again, it was injustice by the media that these black men did not get the same media coverage that a lot of the white men got. And the white men would tell you that themselves.
Wow. Wow. You, when you set out to write this book, you did not do it, I think, a lot of the standard ways that people cover a story like this. They present the facts. It would be told from your perspective. Maybe you'd have some quotes from some of the people that you interviewed. That's not the way that Dark Days of Horror at Dozier, Rapes, Murders, Beatings, and Slavery is set up. You actually...
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, the book was designed to give each one of the men the voice of telling their own story through a chapter of their book, of the book. That's what happened. We wanted to hear it from them. Let the men just tell it. Get it out. Just purge yourself. You've been living with this for so long. Most of them had health issues, you know, just internalizing this pain, this experience, and nowhere to go with it. And certainly trying to get someone to publish a story on this, like, who want to hear about all this sadness? You know, let's get over that. You know, that happened a long time ago. And when someone like Pastor Gaddy or Richard Huntley and the other guys hear that, that just shut them down further. Just really, they will suppress that pain even further. And the only thing that will make them become free is the grave. Because nobody want to hear it. No one believe it. When Pastor Gaddy shared with me for the first time that he had been molested, he had been married almost 50-something years and hadn't told his wife. His wife said, I kind of suspected that that happened, but he never talked about it, nor did he confirm the speculations. But through the book, he talked about a lot of the pain. And that's what happened with Richard and Arthur Huntley and John Bonner. They had an opportunity just to tell it like it happened.
Content.
And that was the only therapy that they really got through the whole process.
Black mental health been one of our key themes for the year. Can you speak about the how poignant it is to have this book, which is essentially co-authored with you and then several of the victims, where so many of these children talk about how they were basically illiterate, and generations of illiteracy even led to them ending up at Dozier Reform School in the first place.
Yeah, and in some cases it wasn't even that. It was just not having a pair of shoes to go to school, and so you didn't go to school, so you was charged with truancy. If your parents was too poor for clothes to go to school, and that's what happened to Pastor Gaddy. So a lot of them was just taken to Dozier without a trial or without any social work or anyone working with them. And Pastor Gaddy said, the first thing he said is that the officer told him, I'm your daddy now. You know, so it wasn't that Pastor Gaddy created a crime. The only crime he had was just being poor. And when you're poor, and you know, you didn't have all of those policies in place that you have now to protect children in some ways. You just didn't have that then. And now we're talking about, once again, during a time where segregation was at the all, you know, the highest, you know. And so who was there to represent the black boys? There was no one to represent them. No one.
Wow.
Absolutely no one.
What are the years, just for our listeners, that the Dozier School was in operation?
Dozier opened its doors in 1911, and it closed its doors 2011, almost 100 years. Well, it was 100 years. And they didn't close their doors until the men, Roger Dean Kaiser, led that effort to make sure that those doors was closed. And, you know, during the entire time that I was listening to these interviews, there was a lot of crying, a lot of purging. One of the stories that really stuck out to me today is the White House, what they call the White House. And the White House, where all the beatings took place, and when the men gave their story about the time they would go in there to get their beatings, and they was told to call them spankings, and the board that they were spanked with, as well as the fan would be turned on to keep them from screaming, and how the blood and the vomit was on the pillows, and the little boys would be screaming, you know, blue murder, and they would come out there with blood running across down their legs. They couldn't sit on their backsides. So it was really torture for these children, you know, really torture.
Wow. Wow. You, for folks in the book, folks, I guess either people listening, and I'm sure this has come up before, who would say, well, wait a minute, Miss Harrell, this, you know, does not have anything to do with racism, because white children were here too, and they were mistreated at Dozier, and some of the abusers, some of the folks who, adults who worked at Dozier who were beating these black children, they were black too. So this has nothing to do with racism. What would your response be?
Absolutely. Okay. I guess I would respond by saying it depends on the situation. Yeah, sure. That was okay. Let me define the racism line. Most of the white boys that was there, they was able to learn a trade, whether that trade would be becoming an electrician, plumber, carpenter. The black boys basically had to work in the field, cutting down the timber. So the racism was there was different work going on at different times and with different groups. The black men, I heard all of them say to the white boys, what hard work did you do? You was in the class learning how to get a trade, whether that would be repairing televisions, radio, electrician, plumbers. But the black men stressed the fact that they had to work in the field. They had to cut down the trees. So there was a difference there. You know, and being called niggers. You little niggers. So it was a different treatment. And also, too, the black men could not beat a little white boy. But the white men could beat the black boys. But the white teachers or officers was not allowed to touch the white boy.
Wow. You have in, this is chapter 11 on page 169, where the closing thoughts, wrapping up one of the sections, you write, white boys at Mariana went to school, and this is the Dozier School. It went by different names throughout this basically century,
yes,
of operation. White boys at Dozier went to school and learned electrician skills, dentistry, etc. Not the black boys. White boys got certificates for their training, not the black boys. In the end, when it was all over at the reform school, the disciplinary action, the farm, the beating of the black boys, and we returned to our homes, what kind of educational structure and skilled trades did we have to fall back on out in the real world as a result of our free labor? And that is all a question, but I think that, you know, makes the point exactly what you said. And I also don't want it lost on our listeners the symbolism of the residence where the beatings took place being named the White House. I think that that is symbolically significant in a system of white supremacy. And that passage that you just heard about the distinction between the how the white children were treated and the black children, that was the chapter from Mr. Richard Huntley, who was at this institution when he was 11 years old. Just one of the other aspects I thought was really important as well that kind of shows this, how the racism plays out, even where you do have children, white and black children at this institution, where they all are experiencing some kind of abuse. But the white supremacy is still a major defining element of how this institution operates. Even after all of this comes out and people are talking about these atrocities and, oh, how terrible it was and someone should do something, there still seems to be racism. This is chapter 8, the black boys at Dozier Reform School, where in the book it says, it was very disappointing to me to learn and accept the fact that the White House boys group seemed to be as racist as the oppressors who staffed Dozier. No matter how the group sought justice and closure for everything, they refused to give blacks credit for a job well done, and they were oppressive and insensitive to our need to be heard and understood. Who would think men who had been abused and treated in some ways almost as badly as the blacks would so easily turn their backs on us while all along pretending to be our brothers? Blacks had to separate and form our own group, the black boys at Dozier Reform School, with our own agenda in order to get our stories out to the public and pursue our quest or closure. Can you just speak to this difference in terms of how the white students at Dozier, how they've responded to the black children?
Yeah, well, first of all, most of the men who, except for John Bonner, Richard Huntley, Arthur Huntley, and Pastor Johnny Gay, they attend Dozier when it was segregated, so they was on the black side of the campus. John Bonner was integrated into with the white side of the campus. But I can really speak on what one of the writers, the authors, was referring to. He said that they wasn't treated the same even by those who referred to them as brothers, because when the media came, they wanted to make sure their story was heard or what happened to the white boys was heard. But no one was focusing on what happened on the black side of the campus. So maybe if they had one black person to tell their story to 20 white boys, that was white men that was there to tell their stories. So the black men wasn't even receiving the justice in the media. And so that's why they felt the need to form black boys at Dozier with their own agenda, their own press conference, their own candlelight vigil, their own meetings, so that they could draw the attention to tell the entire story, because it was a segregated campus. So how could you have the whole story without having what happened on the north side of campus? And I just want to put the emphasis on the fact that each one of those cottages had names after prominent pioneering black people, like the George Washington Carver College, Bethune College, Robinson College, and all of these pioneering African-American people. But yet what was happening inside those colleges was nothing that either one of those pioneering people would have stood up for. They wouldn't have stood for that, the abuse that those children lived with every day. When I went into some of the files at the Tallahassee State Archives, and I was looking in some of those, it brought me to the fact of to think about the thesis that was written by, I can't call the person's name right now, but they wrote a thesis. And when they, because at one time the girls was on the campus too, and then it became the girls and the boys were separated. I think the girls were sent to Okeechobee and the boys were still at Dozier. But I remember reading this paragraph where these children was lying on this damp floor. It was dark, and it was just really, they had chains on them like shackles, and you know, the state regulations start to come in and make some regulations where it was, you know, against the law to treat children like this. But a lot of children was being treated in inhumane conditions. And so the state, the agriculture department ran the school at that particular time. So as the decades moved on and other changes and policies was put in place, but there was a lot of articles that was written about the abuse that these children were suffering at the hands of the employees at the school.
Wow. Context of white supremacy, Antoinette Horrell. One of the things, and you touched on it briefly already, they had a code, it seems, the individuals who ran the Dozier facility. They had a code to keep all this in place. They know all this gruesome, savage abuse is taking place. So they would do things with words and how language was used to help conceal this. One of the things you mentioned, they did not call these beatings. They didn't use that term. They said they're spankings. And they would censor, if the children were writing home to their parents or family members, they would censor the letters, even some of the portions that I read. They would tell them what to write, and you had to copy that exactly, and then they would look to make sure that you wrote that so that you're not telling your parents and family members, you know, hey, I'm being raped or I'm being beaten. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, all of the men said the same thing. They was told what to write, and they was told to family parents that they were so happy and things was fine. And all of them said that when they first put their foot on the campus, they thought that they was going to have a great time because it was such a beautiful, well-maintained campus, and they really thought that this was going to be a great experience or a good experience until the hellish life started. And so it was very deceiving for most of the boys. They couldn't believe that this place that was so beautiful and the yards was maintained, everything was so maintained, but behind, it was like Pastor Gaddy said, he said, I've been to hell. It's like some form of hell, and demons was let out the pits of hell on earth to attack these children, you know. And today, just interviewing those men, I feel like that's part of me. It's in my thoughts now, and it's only in my thoughts, but it's in their mind every day what they have lived with. They have never received any type of psychological counseling for what they went through. Most of them, what they told me, they haven't even scratched the surface to tell me everything that they have witnessed, and some of the murders that took place, the beatings that took place, the boys being raped, the blood. You know, that's a lot to traumatize a child. And I couldn't, it was hard. It was very hard for me to imagine a child 11 years old going through it. I'm a mother, I'm a grandmother, and I certainly couldn't imagine my grandkids or my children going through that, nieces and nephews. But this was a reality for Richard, Arthur, Pastor Gaddy, and John, and so many other black men, and as well as the white men that was on that campus. But I'm speaking about the horrible atrocities that took place with the black men on that campus.
Just to share some of that, this is from the section of the book written by Johnny Lee Gaddy, Pastor Johnny Lee Gaddy. This is Chapter 5, Pedophile Paradise, where Mr. Gaddy, he writes, "Sad to say and awful to remember, but Florida's the Dozier School had to be a dream come true for adult male pedophiles who liked little boys. They couldn't have asked for a better setup. Terrorize the boys all day, then do whatever they want with them at night with no fear of having to pay any legal price for sexually abusing little boys over and over. They had their pick of the boys. The boys couldn't complain or report their abusers. Who could they complain to? There was no one on campus that cared about protecting the rights of these little human pieces of state property, and there was no way to try to get help from anyone off campus.
I was one of the boys who got chosen to be sexually abused at night. It was the director. I never told my wife before deciding to take my story public, but she said she kind of always knew. The director promised he'd kill us if we told. He took more than just me at different times, and he was a teacher. Our cottage father knew about it too. It wasn't an easy thing to try to live down. He would come at different times at night. He'd come by and take me and other boys. The cottage father let him take us. He would have us for a couple of hours. The boys knew when he came by and got you, they know what was going to happen to you, but we weren't allowed to talk to anybody about it. It hurt. It was a pain I never wanted to experience again in my life. It happened maybe 6 or 7 times. I tried to block it out of my mind. I will stop there. I was reminded in reading this devastating passage, Dr. Tommy Curry, when he's on the program, he consistently, and I've said this repeatedly, when we're talking about slavery, rape is one of the central aspects of slavery, the rape of black people. It doesn't come out very much at all, but I do hear it sometimes where they'll talk about the rape of black females, reminded of Harriet Jacobs. I think it's there and a few other stories. But I also say that this happened a lot to black males, black children, and even older.
That's right.
And that just gets totally, it gets totally left to the side. And this, to me, just sounds like a continuation of that legacy. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, and the reason for that, Johnny was the only one that talked about it. But some of the other men, although you know, but they wouldn't talk about it because it's hard for a man to think about his manhood and don't want anybody to know that happened to him and what they was made to do, perform oral sex and that kind of thing. That's not an easy thing to talk about with anyone, whether it's a female or male. But when you talk about a male, it's even worse. And one of the things that we do not talk about, even in our research of slavery, about the sexual abuse of boys on these plantations. And so Johnny was brave enough, and he wanted to be free. He just, you know, when you're tired of living with something and, if it wasn't for him being a pastor, this is what he told me, he would be out of, you know, he'd have lost his mind because he couldn't handle that. And we think about what rape does to women. Some women cannot, you know, get beyond that. And this is what happened with a lot of these men. They try to block it out and dismiss it, and they don't ever want to have to confront that skeleton in the closet. And that's what happened with a lot of the men, and even the ones that told me it happened, but they didn't want me to come public with it or share it. I respect that because they had already been hurt enough, and they didn't need to feel that violation of me violating their trust. And so, but I wasn't surprised. I wasn't surprised at all because it wasn't something that was new to me, and all the time that I had been researching and conducting oral interviews and reading letters that was packed away in dusty attics or in the National Archives and the Penage Files, Record Group 60. It wasn't a surprise because some of the records from the Department of Justice or the FBI or the NAACP, it alludes to the fact that there was a lot of sexual abuse, especially with children, And when Johnny said there was no one to tell, well, that too. Now, mind you, I have interviewed over 200 people. Oh, that's a lot of people to interview. And sometimes the setting would be about 50 people or 60 people in a room if they knew that I was coming. We would have a private meeting in somebody's home. They would just talk to me. But most of them was fearful because the same surnames was the people that was in office now or held some type of position. Their employment depends on the people. And they was afraid to talk about it. And so it was easy just to try to live with it,
but do not tell anyone. And so when I ran across people like that, I respect that, because when I leave, I was going probably into a whole different area. And I didn't want to pick up the phone and call back then and someone tell me somebody got killed last night. Those things would happen. I remember interviewing a man, we call him Papa King. Papa King was 100 and, I think it was 107 or 8 when he died. And when I first started interviewing him and he started telling me about his life as a slave, he was watching TV one day and he saw this white person on the TV, this white man, and he thought the man was coming to get him off the television. And he said, oh, my God, they're coming to get me. I done told that baby the story, and now they're coming to get me. He actually went in the hospital. So after I learned from his daughter that he was hospitalized, I didn't interview him no more for about 4 years. And 4 years went by. I think it was at that time that CNN had called me concerning the story with him, and he opened up a little bit more to tell me some more. But he was right on target with the names and what he did, what he took him to. So it wasn't a surprise. So Dozer is no, it was just a big plantation operated by the state and elected officials, appointed officials, and every other department that you can think of.
Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest, Ms. Antoinette Harrell. I mean, that is, it's profound on so many levels. I feel obligated to make sure that I include Pastor Gaddy. He continues the next week. He talked about if one of the black children, if they ran away, they had slave catchers and they would go out with the dogs and they would track you down and bring you back. And then you're going to get, you know, an extra beating. You're going to be mauled. The dogs might get you. But he also included just with this, the infinite sexual perversions. On 62, he says, when they would catch a runaway boy, they'd make him kiss the dog's private part like a reward for the dog. And this comes up more than once in the book, some saying the same thing. Another person said that sometimes they would pick up the dog's tail and make the black child kiss the dog's anus. Just these humiliations, when we talk about not wanting to talk about this, and the long-term damage, suffering in this manner. I mean, it's difficult to read. I mean, it's extremely important, but it's hard to fathom having generations of black people subjected to this sort of thing. Just to the comment that you just shared about this ongoing terrorism that they experienced, and Papa Kane, what he experienced just seeing this white man on television. I wanted to juxtapose that with what's written. This is on page 115 by Mr. Huntley, where he says, he's talking about how they ended up in custody. And so he says, the police kept us there for about 2 days, then returned us to our mother. She wanted to know what the police put us in jail for. They said they put us in jail for walking in the wrong neighborhood and looking for something to steal because my brother told them he knew a shortcut to get back home. I was just following my brother home. Our mother questioned us but decided to take sides with Whitecap, that's the police officer. She believed that whatever the white folks said, they were right, because white folks wouldn't tell you a lie. I learned at an early age that not just my mother, but mostly all black people at that time basically sought the same way. To satisfy the white man, they did anything. They would help catch us, their own people. They would hold us. They would take all of their problems to the white man, and whatever the white man said or did, it was right. I remember as a young boy what the old timers used to say. You do what them white folks tell you, 'cause they ain't gonna never tell you nothing wrong. Ain't that a blip? Just can you talk about this level of mental programming that comes out in this passage and leads to this fear that you described with Papa Kane?
Well, it's very much alive today. We talked about it early on in the show. No matter how many books I would write or how many films we can produce, it was not validated that Doug Blackman said it was true.
And he was able to have, because he was a journalist, he was able to get the fundings so people believed it. It must be true because Doug Blackman said it was true. And once again, yes, what he said in his book was the truth, but we're talking about the validation at this point. I would like to get Pastor Gaddy to be on your show if you would have him, because to hear it in the first person and hear it from him would do a great justice to your listening audience out there, as well as you, to hear it from him. Let him tell you.
Absolutely. I thought that repeatedly.
Dozer was a living hell.
Mm.
Yeah. He was a living hell. It was a living hell. And children go through living hells. And, you know, I see it today. And it's all because most people say, well, it's not my business. You don't think that the people around there, the black people that was there as well, lived in Marianna, you don't think they know what was going on? They knew what was going on. But let's bring it back to the time period in slavery. When the fear was put in, they would go and get all the former slaves out of the enslaved Africans out of the cabins or whatever, and they would beat that person, or they would take the horse and put it in the opposite direction to just tear the body, to put that level of fear. When you can do something to a person, they're too afraid to talk about it. They're afraid. You can do this. I can rape your daughter, but you better not say nothing. And if you say something about it, I'm going to kill you. I'll kill your whole family.
Mm.
That's what they went through.
Mm.
And sometimes we have to, you know, this is the first interview that I have done probably in about a year. And I had to leave it alone for a minute because talking to people that look like me, that's what was frustrating me. Because how could you not believe? Are you disconnected? Are you trying to ignore it? But anyone who knows that their ancestors were slaves and know the history of slaves, why should this surprise you? Or pretend that it doesn't exist? I can't pretend that it doesn't exist. When I look at the prison industrial complex now, that's another form of slavery. There's so many forms of slavery that's taking place right now. But if we knew our history and would say, okay, well, I'm not going to try to ignore this. You can't ignore everything. You can't keep sweeping things under the carpet like it doesn't exist. As long as it doesn't exist for my family, oh, it happened a long time ago. And so that, why don't you just get over that? I hear that so many times. But I owe it to my ancestors. I owe it to those that want to know, and certainly owe it to the children. Because history has a way of repeating itself. We don't want to know. At one time, our ancestors, they weren't allowed to read and write. We can read. We can write. Now, what is our excuse for not reading or writing or researching and telling? Because we want our kids to believe that it's okay, that this never exists. White supremacists is gone. But it wasn't until all these murders that's taking place around the country that people started saying, oh, well, we better start telling the kids the truth about these lynchings. We better start telling the kids the truth about Claude Neal, who was lynched in Marianna, Florida. It didn't go away. It never left. Johnny Castagnetti is a living witness to that. It never left. Richard Utney. The reason that those boys was being sent to the reform school in the first place was to work in the fields. Free labor. What better way to get it from children?
Context of white supremacy. We absolutely would love to have Pastor Gaddy on the program. I thought about that repeatedly as I was reading the book, like, wow, that was a major error on my part. I should have invited them, your co-authors, from the very beginning. But absolutely, if he would be willing to come speak with us, that, I mean, would be that's something I recommend all the time, telling folks to, if you have grandparents, or if you're fortunate to have great parent grandparents, older Black people in your family, or just people that you know, really make an effort to talk to them and get some of their observations and experiences, because you can learn a lot that is not going to be published in a book or in documentaries. You can learn a lot about the system of racism, things that have happened, that just invaluable information to really take advantage. So absolutely, we would love to hear from him directly. Just in what you just shared in terms of Black people living around this part of Florida and maybe knowing about some of the things that happened in Dozier, certainly you had Black employees who participated in all this. You include in the book, this is on page 21, kind of 21, going over to the top of 22. This is Mr. John Bonner, where he writes, he's talking about one of the Black people that worked there. He calls him Evan. So Evan was not satisfied with this beatdown. He made me get into the Blue Goose, which is a vehicle, which is a state car, and he took me to the White House for the second worst beating of my life. The white woman beating was the worst. By this time, I had toughened up to the beating, but I think that the cussing and calling me little nigger, little red motherfucker, and all that kind of stuff really took a toll on my brain. It deprived me of any kind of self-esteem. The little that I had, or thought I had, I wasn't aware of any, but if any was there, he took that away by him being a Black man and treating me like that. And his Blackness kind of reminded me of my father. He was a savage, local-raised Negro. He had to have had a point to prove to his white superiors. He tried to show them that he did not care or give a damn about these little nigger boys. What the Black man did to me really hurt me more than what the white man did, because here was a Black man like my daddy or my neighbors or people who taught me, and I'm seeing this Black man, my own kind, in full attack mode on me. I expected that from the white boys, but from him, it really took my mind through a psychological loop, being a 14-year-old boy at that time. Thought this was a really stunning paragraph as well. Can you talk about this dynamic in the system of white supremacy, slavery, any era where the incorporation of Black people to carry out these deeds and beatings on behalf of white people? Miss Harrell, are you still with us? Not hearing. Oh, yes, ma'am. We can hear you now.
It's no different than some of the overseers that I heard people call them the straw boss. May Louise Miller, she referred to them as the straw boss. And the straw boss was worse than the white person, the white man, because he always has something to prove. That I can do it harder, massa. Massa, I can do it. You ain't got to do that. Don't get your hands dirty, massa. I can do it. I got this nigga. I got him. And they would actually be harder and worse in every case where I talk with people like me, people like John Bonner. They always talked about the disenfranchisement, the harsh treatment, the inhumane treatment that they received from people that looked just like them. And that was hurting because they was looking to those people that looked like them to protect them, but they didn't know that they was just as much the enemy. And so it wasn't uncommon at that time because, you know, hey, they're going to give you cookie oil and pat you on the head. You did good, boy. You did good, you know. And so they was always looking for acceptance from the white people. And so that's why they would be harder on
people like John. And yes, it does leave a terrible impact. And I heard May say that a lot of times, how sometimes the straw boats would even take and hold the children down and do whatever they need to do.
That's in the book quite a bit. Some of the victims, some of the black children in all this, they talk about how even sometimes they would use black children to hold down other black children while they were being beaten.
Yeah.
Do you think that that is done deliberately by these racist overseers to get this straw boss, as you said, to get this black person to come in and participate in the beating so that black people, just to annihilate that self-esteem and to really give us a very low opinion of other black people, including ourselves? Do you think that's being done deliberately?
Yes. It's for several reasons, you know. And so that's why sometimes we don't feel the pain right now when something happens to one of us. Because it is an imprint on the DNA that was left up on us. And so I often ask myself sometimes, why are we so disconnected from each other? But slavery had a direct impact on why we're so disconnected. So, you know, when someone had to take that, had to be punished as well by holding that person down. Look at the message that you send in that person. If you don't do what I tell you to do, you are next. This is what I'll do to you as well. So sometimes to try to save yourself, you will go through that because you know that they would kill you, that you know that they would beat you. And with children, it's just easier to get children to be submissive to whatever and not to resist. So it's very easy with children to put the fear in them. And it's to kids who know that they didn't have anybody coming to see about them. And even if they did come, parents did come and see about their children, there wasn't much power that those families had. So it's a very, just talking about it right now. And like I said, I hadn't talked about this in a year. I kept up with everything that was going on with exhuming the bodies and what's going on right now with meetings, but I actually had to purge myself for you because the pain was so intense for me to deal with. But I wanted to tell everybody everywhere I go, and I just couldn't beat that drum loud enough. And I felt like the reason I couldn't beat that drum loud enough because people wanted to run away from pain. They wanted to laugh, like Dr. King said. They wanted to scratch when it wasn't itching. They wanted to laugh when it wasn't funny, you know. And so, and that's just to be able to cope with the sickness, the mental illness, the sickness of seeing these demonic things happen. And you say, how could that happen? How could these people do this? But I come to the conclusion these was demons in the form of human beings.
Context of white supremacy. See, we had a couple folks who dialed in with questions. I definitely want to get them in as well. Just a couple last things I wanted to ask also. As I stated in the book, it does pop up. This is on page 36, where one of the victims, he writes that many of the boys were used for medical experiments. Pharmaceutical companies were giving the drugs. I was on the Lantan, supposedly to calm me down so I'd stay out of trouble. Other guys were on other psychotropic drugs. They were experimenting on us. They gave Johnny Gatti some kind of cocktail. Did you get more mm-hmm. information about some of this medical experimentation that was happening?
Yeah, it was a Dr. Susie soup. That's what they call it, Dr. Susie soup. And it was supposed to be where he would put these electric connectors on your head and have you to drink this soup. And as I went deeper into the research to look at who was this man, come to find out the man didn't even have a license. They never found a license on that this man was licensed to even practice being a doctor. And so these boys are going there, and they don't know what they was giving them. They really have no idea. And he was giving it to both black and white boys. So it was, Pastor Gatti was one of them who was receiving this Dr. Susie soup.
Wow. That, as I said, hopefully we can get Pastor Gaddy on to hear more about this, but I mean, medical apartheid, that one of the most important books that I have read, black author Harriet A. Washington. I would definitely encourage folks to read the long running pattern. And she talks extensively about how black children, particularly if they're in some sort of incident exactly like this, if they're in a facility like Dozier, easy pickings. We can go in and do anything we want. Who's going to stop us? Who's going to question us? Who's going to defend these little nigger children? She has chapters upon chapters talking about that. You actually started the book, again, Dark Days of Horror at Dozier, Rapes, Murders, Beatings, and Slavery. You started this book off with one of the I guess, common tropes in studying the system of white supremacy, a black person being punished with regards to a white woman. Why did you start off with one of these children being beaten for what it's called reckless eyeballing?
Well, because it reminds me of what I heard a lot of elders say, that they better not get caught looking at a white woman. And so when John Bonner said that they accused him of looking at this white woman, and he didn't look at her, and they beat him for what they call reckless eyeballing, it reminds me of the stories I heard during the Civil Rights Movement and Jim Crow, where I heard some of the families who I interviewed, and people even in my own family, how they could not look at a white person. They could not. If you got caught looking at a white woman as a boy, anything can happen to you. Well, that's what happened. That's how he ended up getting beat that day. Reckless eyeballing just meant he was supposed to have been looked at a white woman. And you dare not look at a white woman. Whatever you do, you dare not do that.
I think he says this is the worst beating that he got while he was at Dozier for being accused of reckless eyeballing. I guess the last question, or last two, number one, has anyone affiliated with Dozier ever been convicted, charged of a crime in all of this? Oh, Miss Arell. Oh, no. Lost her again. I will dial her back, see if we can get her. I do see the folks who dialed in with questions. We'll see if we can get her back. Could be racist interference to be expected. All right, we'll dial in her back, see if we can get her.
Antoinette again. To answer your question, no. Tidwell was the only person that was living. They called him the one home person that was doing all the beating, but it just came back that no one will be charged with any criminal activities for what has happened to these children.
Wow. Wow. Standard operating procedure. And thus far at this point, has there been any compensation, reparations to any of the victims who are still alive or their family members?
No, there's still ongoing discussions, but certainly nothing, no reparations. Some of the bodies they have offered to pay to have those bodies moved to the burial site of the family's choice. And that's up to, I think it was $7,500 or something of that nature, but nothing to the surviving people who have went through what they went through.
Also, standard operating procedure. I see the folks that dialed in with questions. Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Miss Antoinette Harrell? You should be with us.
Yes, I have one question. Thank you for taking my call, Doug. Good evening, Miss Antoinette.
Good evening.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any information of this happening anywhere else outside of Florida? That's my only question. Thank you.
Yeah, I had a call from several calls from a young woman that was talking about a school here in Louisiana. But certainly there's other schools, there's other jails, there's other reform schools that have been reported with these sort of things.
Right on. Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. Retired firefighter in Florida, right where all those ground zero for a lot of this. Do you have any questions for Ms. Harrell?
Yes. Greetings, Ms. Harrell.
I
am thinking that the Cuban, the Miami Herald ran a expose on this torture chamber years ago. I think it lasted for about a week. And would you be familiar with that? That it ran
no.
ran stories. Okay. But it's just like you said, that for the most part, they interviewed and talked about the white people who were in their conditions that they were in. And that's how the article threw me off. And I should have known better. I should have known better that it had to be some black people involved in a negative way, not to their best interest. Is it true that a lot of the black kids that were killed, they didn't mark their graves? Would that be correct?
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. There was a lot of unmarked graves there.
That is about so the only. Go ahead, ma'am.
That's why the DNA was so important to collect from some of the family members. But we got to keep in mind that some of these graves dates back to maybe like 1930, 1920, and family members have no idea what happened to their loved ones, never seen them again. So there will be a lot of unclaimed bodies with that situation, because some family members had no idea where their loved ones went. They just was told it left.
And like I said, overwhelmingly, I don't even remember them interviewing no one who was black, but I specifically remember them interviewing white males, primarily who were at that institution back in the 50s and the 60s, if I'm not mistaken. And it basically, the only thing I got out of it, it was kind of like a rough reformatory. You know, but they didn't really give it. The last thing I want to do, I want to commend you, ma'am. I can just feel the hard work and what you had to go through to even put this book out, this information out. And all of us should thank you. You know, on what I know is the hard work that you put into this, and because I'm just listening to. What you're saying, you know, about, you know, what you had to go through in order to put it out. And also, you're absolutely correct on how when a white person does it, does the basically the same thing as far as coming along after the fact, that they get better results than we do. And you're absolutely correct on that, of that incorrection. And so I just wanted to make sure that I commended you on the work that you did. And, I'm going to try to get my hands on that book itself so I can really get the real story on that. Thank you, ma'am.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you.
For sure. Roz, did you have a question for Ms. Harrell? You should be with us.
Yes. Greetings to you, Gus, and, greetings to you. Is it Mrs. Hamill?
Ms. Harrell, thank you.
Harrell, excuse me. I'm sorry about that. Sorry about that. Thank you so much, Mrs. Harrell. And just like the previous caller stated, I just want to say thank you and many ancestral blessings, and may they continue to guide and protect you. I had about three questions. The first one is, do you have any idea of what the suicide rate was of the black children at the Dozier School?
No. I went into some of the medical files, and I didn't read any suicide rates at all. I didn't read anything. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. It's just, well, matter of fact, what they said, that a lot of the children who was kill themselves. That was some of the things that they said about the children, and some of the reports that, you know, they went missing, or Pastor Gaddis said the alligators ate some of them, you know, that the kids killed themselves. But I don't believe that.
Okay, thank you. My next question is, because I heard you talk earlier about just how much pain and shame that the people who experienced this have gone through, and their inability to talk about these things because of those feelings that they've been carrying for so long. I wanted to ask you, what role does learning to be patient and loving towards our people, or to one another, play in regards to avoiding this happening again? And when I say that, I mean in the sense that because we have been brutalized to a point where we're taught to be silent and not to tell these stories, a lot of times, like you said, history keeps repeating itself. And I think a big part of it is that we don't love each other. We're so disrespectful and hurtful towards one another that for those people who have had these experiences, they don't feel safe opening up to their children, their grandchildren, their wives, in the case that you were speaking about mm-hmm. earlier. And as a result, these secrets are carried and this stuff gets repeated. So I just wanted to know, in your opinion, what role would just loving one another and being patient with one another and even forgiving, because we're damaged, play towards this us avoiding these things happening again?
You know, one of the things that I love children, and my own experiences I have experienced in this life, those that wasn't so good. The first thing I found myself talking to my grandchildren, reassuring them that it's okay for us to talk about anything and everything. There is no secrets, you know, and even if we hurt one another and that's be disrespectful to each other, we first have to acknowledge that we have to apologize and be cautious with each other, because sometimes those little ugly things that was passed down from one generation to another generation, and it affects it never stops. So you have to ask yourself, where does it stop? How long do I have to put up with abuse? There's a lot of pedophiles in families, and because of who it is, family members will cover it up and they won't say anything about it. The lies. We first have to realize that we are suffering from that slavery syndrome. I don't care what people say. We was in bondage for 400 years, and we only been free from the shackles of slavery, the shackles of these different plantations for 154 years. So we still trying to figure this thing out. And some of us are coming from families that slavery, the different impacts that slavery has had on our individual families. We need to first acknowledge that and look, and then come up with that healing and bring it together in the family. Stop talking about the football game and all the celebrities. First of all, acknowledge that our ancestors went through a lot, and that pain was passed down from generation to generation. You know, the tearing each other down. It goes back to the Willie Lynch letter. You know, the light-skinned against the dark-skinned. You got that good hair versus that bad hair, the short versus the tall, and this one making this much money. You know, all these schisms and isms that constantly divide us. You know, as Willie Lynch said, that I guarantee you this formula that I'm going to give you will keep them in bondage for 400 years, even after they are supposed to be free. Favorite children in the family. All these things, we learned that from slavery. We learned it from slavery. And in 2016, people say, are we still dealing with that? Of course we can. But the first thing we have to do is talk about it. I don't know how many times on January the 1st when people are celebrating, they're celebrating New Year's and really don't know what that really meant for our ancestors who was waiting for that freedom bell to ring. When have we cried? When have we talked about it? Everybody else have a plan. People have set up family plans. But when do we set up our own family plan? It's okay to talk about the slavery. It's okay to talk about Jim Crow and what it did. Now, what are we going to do from here? Let's have better respect for each other, even as siblings, husband and wives, your children. Because if not, we're in trouble. We are in trouble. What is the state of black folks today? I really don't know. But I know we better do something, and we better do it quickly. when my grandchildren get into an argument with each other and I hear it, and I hear the disrespect, I have to stop it right there and teach them about conflict resolution and do it in respect. Don't fight each other. Your fight is not in here with each other. Your fight is out there in that world with that beast out there, with white supremacists, with people who hate you because of the color of your skin, people who hate you because of the gifts that you have within. And you have to stop it. You can't let it go any further. You have to show them what strange fruit really meant. You have to let them see. Show them the pictures. We can't keep shielding them from the truth. As ugly and hurting as it is part of what we have experienced in America. The Jews said, I'll never let you forget the Holocaust. Why are we trying to forget what we went through? Yes, we're moving on. We're going to move on. We must move on. But you must move on knowing the knowledge of the past. It's the past that shapes the present, and the present that shapes the future. I hope I answered your question.
Yes, you did. Thank you so much for that. My final question is, in the description for the show, I saw that you are a genealogist. And I wanted to ask if there were any pointers you can give, or even if you had like your own website with information for black people in the Western Hemisphere to trace their lineage and things of that nature, as far as being able to look into that a little more deeply. And I just wanted to ask you about that because I did see that you were a genealogist. And also,
yes.
And the second part of the question is, what is your take on African DNA testing and how accurate it really is or inaccurate it is? And that is my last two-part question. Thank you so much for being on the program this evening.
Okay, you can follow me on Facebook at Harrell Africa Harrell, Antoinette Africa Harrell. And to answer the question with the African ancestry DNA, I took that DNA and I went to Africa to meet with the Tuareg people. And I could not understand why at the age at 34, 36, I would wear these two long braids all the time. And when I got to Africa and I saw my sisters with the same hairstyle, I started to cry because then I knew. And when I looked at this sister, I saw my mom. When I looked at this brother, I saw my uncles. I knew. And it helped me to understand who I am today. But before you do the African ancestry DNA test, you must go back in the spirit of Sankofa. You have to start where you are and walk your way back. Interview that oldest person in the family. Write those questions down and then let them talk. And then go to joinancestry.com and look at the census. Ask those questions. Where did they come from? Give me some names and write it down. And research your family history. And once you find out, ask them, do you know if they was free people of color, if they were slaves? If so, did anyone talk about the plantation, where they come from? Those are questions. Go to the courthouse. Look in the court in the Vendors and Vendee's book, because your family members was chattel slaves. There was chattel property if they were slaves. Somebody owned them. The secessions and probates of the slaveholders' records are very important. You cannot do your genealogy if your family was slaves without doing their genealogy. And hopefully you will find the inventory where your family was listed, not just on a separate list, but they would be listed with the cows, the hogs, the pigs, the furniture, whatever they had, because your family members was looked at as an object and not as a person. And follow me on Facebook, and I can share more information.
Just posted her Facebook address on our Facebook page. You can check it out there. Super easy. It's linked right with the description for today's broadcast. You can click on it and submit your follow. Other folks, if you all had a question you want to ask, do not lollygag. Wait till last minute. Go ahead and get your hand up now. I thought I saw someone else dialed in with a question, but it looks like they might have got disconnected. So press *6 if you have a question for Ms. Harrell. Thank you kindly. Not waiting till last minute. Call her at 4683. Did you have a question for Ms. Harrell? You should be with us, 4683.
Yes. Hello to everybody. How you doing, Ms. Aurea?
Hello. Thank you. Fine.
Can y'all hear me good?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Hey, Ms. Aurea, I wanted to know, like, what, when you research, and pardon me, because I just got on at 8, so I missed the beginning, but I thought it started at 8, but, I was trying to find out, like, what years did your research cover, like, not how many years you put in, but, like, the periods of times that your research, cover on Arthur Lee Dozier.
Okay, yes. I really started from 1969 back to 1911.
From
68 going back, because John Bonner was there in 1968. The oldest person that I had interviewed, he passed away just last year. He was 82, and so he was there in the 30s. So those years that I really researched was the years that the men who I interviewed, I covered the years that they was there.
Okay, because see, I was in those through 93 to 95, right? And when I was there, they still had the graveyard was there. Now, when I was there, I was in Lincoln Cottage. I was in Lincoln Cottage in from 93 to 95, and it was people, staffs lived on that compound. Now, it was a white lady that was a nurse. And she was an old white lady, but she stayed right there across from that graveyard. But she used a brand of medicine, you know, and she was a real strange lady. Well, I'm willing to bet that lady had a lot to do with them kids getting killed back in them days, because them rumors was there when I was there, you know, about the history of that place. But that lady, I don't know, man. I can't remember her name, but she been there living on that compound for a very long time, because she had been like in her 70s in the 90s. But she was just
there. Was you there when the young man killed? Was you there when the young man? Was you there when that young man was killed in boot camp there? Was you there then?
I don't recall nobody getting killed when I was there. But when I got there, they were just putting the level 10. You know, they had put another program up, because those were like level 8. But they put a 10 up over there where you could do like 7 years or something. But when I was there, you had people escaping. People were running from out of there, and they were still getting jumped on and whipped and all that. But I don't recall nobody dying. But it been so long ago. You know, but if you could find out that white lady that worked that head nurse in the 90s, man, she lived on that property. She stayed. She had a house back there. It was self-staff people that owned houses on that property right back there by where that graveyard was at, behind you know, they had the ISP. That was like the intensive supervision program. And then on the other side, back behind there, that's where like the little massive graves were, you know. But it wasn't no headstones and nothing like that, but everybody knew that it was the graveyard. The rumors been going around a long time. But I want to get your book. Hey, I'm gonna try to find out how to get on here and find everything out. But thank you, ma'am.
May I ask you a question? The Lincoln College was on the white side of the campus, because the black side was closed when you was there, right?
No, ma'am. The back side, when I was there, you had, when you come through the gate, you come all the way around, you had R&O, you had R&O, I forget what it was, something in orientation right there. Then you had like Kennedy. You know, I go around in the loop. It go around like in a like a little like a horseshoe. Now you had Lincoln and Jackson. You had Lincoln and Jackson kind of the back. the little church, that little white building. Oh, I forget what they call it, but it was the only white building. I think you hear a church in there, the chow hall there. But now if you go back behind there, that's where the on-campus people were staying, the people, the free world people live back there.
Mm-hmm.
And then they cleared out their back area. They cleared out some of that back there, and they were supposed. Now, I never seen the new institution they were putting up, but I heard that they did head it up, but they were supposed to be building it. Like, towards I left, I think I left in May 95, and they were bringing in that new building, yeah. But this old white lady, if you ever get back into it, you know, you want to find out that old white lady, I bet you she had a lot of people killed. Because the thing was, she was very provocative, right? She would try to be, but she was real old. But, you know, people, you would hear stories about she let black kids do stuff to her, you know, and she would dress with real tight. Always had a lot of makeup on, kind of like hair, blonde white hair, like Marilyn Monroe. And she just come in and just be smiling, and you could tell. And see, I remember back then, I used to always think, man, something crazy about that lady right there. And she lived on there. She lived right back there behind the ISP building. So, dear boy, thank you. Hey, and Gus, thank you for taking my call, too, man.
Yes, sir. Yes,
well,
sir.
Well, thank you.
The person that dialed in 2812, 2812, did you have a question for Ms. Harrell? You should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Good evening. Thank you for taking my call, and I just want to say this is a wonderful broadcast. I just have a quick question. Actually, while she was talking, I literally was going on Google, and because this is not only sad and sickening, but it's actually very interesting. And one thing that I did notice, ma'am, is there's a site that has all of the names of potential students or people that were involved in some of these incidents, but I mean, I just counted them. I might have seen 3 or 4 names of actually former employees. What have you seen, just based upon your observation, has been the issue with tracking down some of these former employees or people, or specifically, I'm assuming, white males that were in charge to bring these men to justice? And what has been the problem, and with the lack of evidence or just the case in all around? Because I just find it very hard, specifically because white people are bringing this to the light and brought it to the light, that they're having a lot of trouble pinning people down and actually finding out who the employees were, who saw what. Can you speak to that a little bit, if you don't mind?
Well, it's not very hard to find the employees because at the Tallahassee State Archives, a lot of the records from the Dozer School went over to the State Archives. And in some of their books, some of their administrative books and different applications from the teachers, they are there. Especially if some of the men are calling out the names of the people who did this to them, it's easy to find when these people was employed there. But a lot of them have died. The only one that they said that was still living was Tidwell. That's the only person that was living. But my take on that is that because it was a state facility ran, operated by the state, then the state needs to be held responsible. Although most of the people who are deceased, okay, that's true. But it was a state ran facility. A lot of these kids was wards of the state. So if the state of Florida cannot hold and should hold Tidwell responsible, well, the state itself should be responsible because it was a state-operated school.
Mm.
By all means.
Absolutely. I 100% agree. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. Thanks, Gus.
You're quite welcome.
And the person that dialed in from a block number, did you have a question for Ms. Harrell? You should be with us.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening, Ms. Harrell.
Good evening.
Yes, ma'am. have three questions. My first question is that, do you think that slavery still has an effect on us from 500 years ago because it still continues, or is it because it has not been prepared? So therefore, in other words, if we were free from the system of racism, white supremacy, and the system did not continue, would we still be affected as we are today because it's not repaired? Do you get what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, by all means. I mean, slavery lasted for 400 years, but we have only been free from the shackles 154 years. And so my mother's grandfather was a slave. So if my mother's grandfather was a slave, look how close we are. Some people did not get their slavery to 1962. There are some people still on plantations. And so let me just give you an example. If a person was abused and that person turned around and abused their children, and if that cycle is not broken, then that child abuse will trickle down from one generation to the other generation. Well, the evil atrocities of slavery, some of it has not left. We are still practicing. Great example, the food we eat today. You hear people eating chitlins. You hear people eating a lot of foods that's not good. And the first thing they'll tell you, I was raised on this. Well, maybe that's all they had. And so some things we're practicing is a vessel of slavery. Some things we see in the religious practice that we see in our families, it is a leftover residue of slavery. So because we haven't talked about it and society trying to tell us to get over it, move on, it happened a long time ago. Now listen who's saying it happened a long time ago. If a woman is raped, that woman could have been raped at 5 years old, and she can be 55 years old today. That still has an effect on her. So until we can talk about it and talk about what it did to our individual families, what type of plantation did your family come from? I know my family worked on cotton plantation. Some people worked, their family members was on different type of plantations, especially not to forget those plantations where people, where some of the former slave holders was going to school to practice medicine. They was practicing right there with the people on their plantation. So they tell us to get over it, but look who's saying get over it. But it's when we say get over it, yeah, we want to get over it, but we also want to heal internally so that we can do away with those things that left that print in our DNA.
Okay, I understand. I just have three more questions. May I proceed, Gus?
Let's hurry. Yeah, let's hurry because there are other folks who have questions.
Okay, not a problem. My second quick question is that, what is the title of the book so that I can get it?
Black Boys at Dozer Reform School. And I think he put it on the site.
Okay, I'll check that out. My next question is that, how do you undo damage that was violently placed on you? How do you undo that?
I think the first thing, and the way I handle things, first acknowledge that it happened. That's the first thing. That's the first thing we have to do, because a lot of times we will not acknowledge that something happened. And there you cannot even begin to seek a healing. And you have to let it, you have to talk about it. You have to allow it. Stop suppressing it, because when we suppress pain, we damage ourselves. We start to see health issues, high blood pressure, strokes, stressing, because we're carrying some baggage. When we turn around and confront it and say, hey, you know what? I didn't do this to me. It's okay to talk about the abuse. It's okay to talk about it so that I do not want this to go from one generation to the other generation. I see it passed down in families, in my own family.
My last question is that, do you think that white supremacists practice white supremacy because of a culture or a pathology?
I think they fought all the above and privilege. and privilege. That's another thing they practice, because they feel that they're entitled to be superior. And without us realizing it, you know, when we look at our sisters that, you know, want the long flowing hair and all these different things, we make them feel like they are superior, and they're not. And we try to take back our own identity, the natural hair. Okay, they start to make laws. You can't go to school with natural hair. You see, it's those little things like that that make us know that, you know, it's live and well.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Wong. Have a good evening.
Mr. Nero, did you have a question for Mr. Harrell? Ms. Harrell, you should be with us.
Thank you. Greetings to you. Greetings to the callers. Ms. Harrell, thank you so much for coming on the broadcast. I'm not in the quietest place, so I'll be brief. I'm just curious, before you began to do this this work, this study, did this have an impact on how you perceive black men today?
It really made me understand what black men went through, going through. And it really made me love the black man even deeper and understand his plight. Because it hasn't been easy for the black man in many ways. One, when I think about a man who has a daughter or daughters, and a wife, and somebody can just push your door open and come and get your wife and your daughter and have sexual intercourse with your daughter and your wife and then return her back to you, knowing that also she can be impregnated with their child. And you feel helpless when you love your daughter, you love your wife, and your daughter is looking to you to protect her. And she can't understand why daddy didn't do anything. And not to mention what black men have to put up with on jobs today. These are all real topics and real conversations that we all need to have, so that we can better respect each other. The black woman respect the black man. The black man respect the black woman. And teaching our sons to do the same. We haven't faced that yet. And so that's why a lot of times, and I hear it today too, with black women, they measure a man based upon his pocket or what he drives. And that's all by design. If we look at the census starting at 1870, the head of the household was 90% men that was in that household, raising his family, providing for his family. And as the census started to change and more questions started to, they was adding more questions like, do you own, do you rent? In 1900, black folks owned 15.5 million acres of land. Today we're down less than that because women respect their black men. The man was in the household with his sons and his daughters. That was a respect. So to answer your question, it just makes me love the black man and stand by their side, whether that be my brothers, my sons, my cousins, whomever. And until we get back in balance, we're going to see worse things than what we see because we are out of balance.
I totally agree, ma'am. Hopefully we will have you on the broadcast again. Thank you so much for sharing
your
information. I really appreciate it.
Right on. Appreciate that. I think we nabbed all of our callers before we let you exit for the evening. And just want to echo the appreciation you heard from many of the callers, and particularly since you've taken a break from doing interviews on this subject matter. And I certainly can empathize, knowing that this is not the most pleasant subject matter. And we talked about that before, knowing sometimes when you just need to take a break to kind of replenish and just do some self-care, some self-maintenance, because it really can take a toll just listening to all of these stories and all of this pain and sadness about these events and what's happened to these black males, that it can be something where you just have to take a break from talking about and investigating and devoting so much of your focus to that. So I'm glad you were able to come speak with us for the evening. Did you see the documentary film? I think they may have spoken with some of your subjects, Deadly Secrets, The Lost Children of Dozier. I think it just came out not too long ago.
Yeah, I saw it.
What were your impressions?
As always, it just wasn't enough of the African-American presence for the black men. It just wasn't enough for me. And then again, it's not a surprise because we look at who controls the media. You know, so we're grateful for blogs. We're grateful for the blog, radio talk shows, blogging, the internet, social media, because it had it not been for that. And I do want to thank Mother Jones Magazine, Al Jazeera, those and all the people and all the media publication that really heard the black men's plight. I want to thank them for helping us to get the little exposure for these men so that they can tell their story. And I want to thank you too, Gus, for allowing Pastor Gaddy to be a guest on your show whenever you are ready. I will inbox you his phone number. And you can call him, and he'll be happy to come on. He has his own book, Dozier Was a Living Hell. And let him hear you in the first account, because I can't speak about that account. The only thing I can speak about is the interviews that was told to me or what I read. But I actually want your listeners as well as you to hear someone who lived it, who went through it. And that's a big difference there. You know, I can talk about it from a journalist and a researcher, but to hear someone who say, hey, I was there, I went through this. Let me tell you about the hand I saw in the hog pen. Let me tell you about the fire pit. Those are the people that you really want to hear it from, because they're the ones that experience it. And we need to do that as quickly. And the reason I'm saying that is because they're dying off. You know, they're in their 70s, and we need to hear from them before they leave this world, you know. And quite often, too often, we wait till someone is gone, and then we'll try to put the pieces together when we can really hear it like the noun. So thank you, Gus, for having me on the show. And when you first reached out to me, I said, okay, well, he asked, and it's my obligation to tell. But once again, you know, I wasn't trying to lock away the pain, because if someone went through it, I can certainly be the one to help tell it. If the fact was, who wanted to hear it? That was it.
Absolutely. What, just if I can ask really quick, what are your thoughts with all the research that you've done and the continuation of slavery and this form of peonage? What are your thoughts on all of these new films that have come out in the last few years depicting slavery, the 12 Years a Slave and Django and The New Roots, and then later this year, The Birth of a Nation on Nat Turner, The Book of Negroes about the experience relating to Canada? What are your thoughts on all of these dramatizations of black enslavement?
Well, you know, it's necessary to tell the story, who's telling it. But for the most part, I'm still researching, I'm still documenting, I'm still laying the foundation for different research in the areas that I live in. So I don't get to see a lot of films. I'm too busy trying to collect as many the oral histories that I can, still searching courthouses, attics, wherever I can find documentation and putting the information there so that filmmakers like all the producers can have another story or another angle to talk about. But the sharecropping period is one of those issues that we all must look at, because that was the most dangerous form of slavery, was the sharecropping. Is that is it, you know. There was so many different disguises that it disguised itself under involuntary servitude, sharecropping, just different names, but it all served the same purpose. And so I can't wait to a film is made about that. But once again, you know, people say it. It's when we start saying, oh, I don't want to hear that. I don't want to hear no more of those slave stories. Look, let's get past that, you know. You can't ever get past it because it's still live and well. Look at the judge that was sentenced in Pennsylvania to 28 years for selling all those children just recently, you know. So it'll never end. I mean, slavery will never end as long as there's people and greed and money and thirst for material things and dollars. There's always going to be slavery. But we can and we must tell our own story.
Ashe, ashe. The book, if folks want to get Pastor Johnny Gaddy, his book, They Told Me Not to Tell, Dozier Reform School Was a Living Hell. And Miss Harrell, she's a co-author with that. If you want to check that out, I'm going to see if I can get my personal copy so that we can prepare and have him on the program to talk in detail about his experience. The book we discussed today, Dark Days of Horror at Dozier, Rapes, Murders, Beatings, and Slavery. Antoinette Harrell, Richard Huntley, John Bonner, Johnny Lee Gaddy, and Arthur Huntley, all the different authors, many of them the victims who experienced the horrors of Dozier firsthand. Really thoroughly enjoyed having you as a guest on the program. We definitely will want to have you back on the program, and I will message you the information about Mr. Gaddy, having him on the broadcast. It would be a pleasure to be able to speak with him directly.
Yes, by all means. Matter of fact, I will be sending you his contact information very shortly.
Outstanding. Outstanding. Just please take excellent care of yourself and continue this much needed, priceless research that you're doing. I learned a lot reading your book. I'm so glad you could share some of your time with us this Tuesday evening to speak with us on the Cows.
Thank you for having me, okay?
Oh, for sure. For sure. Enjoy the rest of your evening, and we will be in touch with you soon, Ms. Harrell.
Thank you. Good night.
Good evening. Context of White Supremacy. Fantastic information. The book, again, Dark Days of Horror at Dozier, Rapes, Murders, Beatings, and Slavery. Grand information. Grand information. I had tried to get the white people who did the documentary film that I asked her about, Deadly Secrets. It just came out, I think, earlier this summer. I think like June or so it was released. And they were messaging and going back and forth, and I sent them some sound clips so they could get an idea of the program, and then they just cut off communication, which happens regularly, particularly with suspected racist guests, when they are like, uh-oh, these niggers here, I don't think we're going to talk to them, never mind, and they just stop communication altogether. I was very interested in seeing the film and then seeing why these white people wanted to do this work. I really appreciate Ms. Harrell and the research that she's done for years, because most of the time when I see reports, when they do things on like NPR and some of the more mainstream outlets, it's whites who are at the center. They are the folks. It'll be whites that are working at some of the major colleges, universities in the state of Florida, who are doing the exhumations and are on the site of the Dozier School and trying to find out where the remains are, and this happened and that happened. You got to have an expert, have to have a white person in that's doing all of this. And I suspected that they are not, as she said, that they are not going to adequately, accurately reflect how white supremacy was at the center of all of this. I'm just super glad we had her on the program, and we're going to work to see if we can get Pastor Gaddy on the program as soon as possible. I think that would be great. And again, just encourage folks who, if you are in a particular area, wherever you happen to be at in the world, this is one of the reasons why there should be some devotion to making sure that you have an understanding of racism, white supremacy, local, national, global, how all of this works, how it's put together. I know if I was in Florida, if I was born there, if I lived there, devote some time and energy to studying this. This is one of those that you can talk to your children about. And once again, this is the sort of thing, not just presenting this as ancient history, this is ongoing. This is how we get to a Trayvon Martin. This is how we get to a Jordan Davis, so that they can understand this in with a historical context, in terms of just grasping that this is not just something that happened today. There is a legacy of this, that there is white dedication to terrorizing, pillaging black people, all areas of activity, and this is what we have got to do. This is why we have got to devote our time and energy to solving this problem, because this is just going to continue happening. But certainly, I know we have a lot of residents in Florida, this is something you should be knowledgeable about. I'd say Ms. Harrell's book should definitely be one that's in your library, where you can talk to folks about this. Might even be some of your family members have knowledge or heard something about all this. Could spark some interesting conversations, particularly if you have family, friends that are in the Florida area. We just have a quick news clip. This is some of the black victims at Dozier talking about their experience, and then we'll be right back if anybody has any concluding thoughts they want to get in. Context of white supremacy. Again, this is some of the black victims from the Dozier Reform School giving their segment. This is a local Florida news station.
The men who shared their stories lived on the part of the campus where researchers are trying to exhume at least 100 bodies in unmarked graves. A road separates the area from the rest of the campus.
We're here to wake up America concerning Dozier. That's why we're here.
That's Florida chairman of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Art Rocker, speaking in front of dormitories on the so-called black side of the Dozier campus. The school, notorious for decades of harsh treatment of boys, closed 2 years ago. Johnny Gaddy was 11 years old in 1957 when he says police picked him up in Dade City and sent him to Dozier. He says guards would send dogs after boys who tried to run away, and he never saw several of them again. What's more, he was counseled not to talk about what he saw.
And when I was taking the pit, the garbage to the pit, and I told the guy, I looked just like a boy hand right there. He said, Johnny, don't ever say that again. He said, if you want to not be like that, don't ever say that again. So everything we seen and heard, we just had to not see it and not hear it.
School records show admittance dates for several boys, but no corresponding release dates. Researchers want to exhume bodies there to find out whether it's a case of shoddy record keeping or something worse. Paula Johnson, a Syracuse University law professor who heads the Cold Case Justice Initiative, says her team supports University of South Florida anthropologist Erin Kimmerly in her fight to get exhumation permits from the state.
And so even though these harms happened in the 40s and the 50s and into the 1960s, there is never a time limit on demanding justice and on getting justice.
Florida Secretary of State Ken Detzner has denied previous requests to exhume the bodies at Dozier, but State Attorney General Pam Bondi says Detzner misunderstood the law and should have granted the permit. Bondi and the rest of the Florida cabinet, including Governor Rick Scott, will take up the permitting issue once again on Tuesday. For WFSU News, I'm Jessica Palumbo.
Context of white supremacy. Again, hopefully we'll have Pastor Gaddy on the program soon. I'm going to be working to get his book, Post Haste. The title, again, if folks want to check it out, They Told Me Not to Tell. Dozier Reform School was a living hell. And in my view, I think it's also important with this report, the system of white supremacy, deception, that is one of the main tools, and whites directly, indirectly conditioning us to lie lie to ourselves, lie to each other. A big part of lying is omission, willful omission of pertinent information. That's one of, I think a lot of times people think of a lie just as someone giving false information, but it is also a lie when you deliberately withhold pertinent information. And that sort of thing, they condition us to do all the time. And yes, there is a lot of deliberately saying things that are inaccurate, saying things that are false, but deliberately remaining silent about critical aspects of things that have happened to us, crimes that whites have committed against us. That is, I mean, central to the system of white supremacy. And I thought it was so important. I was really glad that the victims in the book kind of pointed that out, that this suppression of what happened to them and just burying it, not talking about it, not thinking about it, not sharing, that this was started at the very institution, that that was a part of the code as to how they operated the Dozier plantation. One of their methods of terrorism, all right, we're going to write these letters to your parents, but you're going to copy exactly what we want you to say. We're going to read the letter. We're going to censor it. If you do it incorrectly, you could be punished, beaten, whatever the case, or we just won't send it to your parents. That way, we will control the narrative. Same thing that you see happening now. We will control the narrative about how this will be reported, thought of, and the use of words. We're not going to call it, we're not going to say that you were mauled. We're not going to say that you were beaten. We will say you were spanked. Critical use of words to maintain the system of white supremacy, and as well as getting black people to participate in the beatings. I think we heard of some of that from Sioux Africa yesterday. But that is a critical component of the system of white supremacy. I know Mr. Fuller, he points out from Kwame Ture, a.k.a. Stokely Carmichael, his book Ready for Revolution. He details, and I'm sure it's in other books too, but I know it's he describes it graphically there. He talks about when Fannie Lou Hamer in Mississippi during the 1960s, when they were making their efforts against counter-racism or making their efforts against white supremacy racism, when she was placed in greater confinement, Fannie Lou Hamer, the racist guards, they didn't beat Fannie Lou Hamer directly. They got black inmates to do it. And Mr. Fuller explained, like, hey, you don't want to do it? No problem. We'll just make sure that you get the worst work detail tomorrow, or we'll make sure that you don't get any cornbread tomorrow, and we'll just go until we find somebody who is willing to do it, and we'll get them a bigger piece of cornbread, an extra pillow, you know, extra sip of water, whatever the case may be. We got lots of ways. When you are in control, it is very, very easy to manipulate the people that you dominate into doing all kinds of things that are against their self-interest. And frequently, black people, daily, really, hourly, we are conditioned, manipulated, threatened to do things that are against our self-interest, primarily harming other black people, including ourselves, but primarily harming other black people. Grant, before we get to the calls, I just want to say at the outset, this is not the time and place where we will dissect Sioux Africa, what went down yesterday. Not that I'm trying to deny folks an opportunity to comment on a hoot of an exchange. It's just that I would like to have some sound clips present so that I can take my time to go through and pick out some of the great bits, and we can just make a dissection of it. We've done this before. Barbara Trepanier is one of the more infamous times that I can recall, but I think it would be worthy to kind of go through and talk, give some of my thoughts, and then hear what you all have to say as well. But that is not today. Anyone, I know there were some tech issues where it was not as clear. I think today it was clear. I think it was just for whatever reason, Ms. Harrell, her line disconnected a few times. But yesterday, I think there were some tech issues that where it was not quite as clear as I would have liked that made it difficult. The archive should be pristine. So if anyone had trouble listening to the live Rcast, I would encourage checking out the archives because you will be able to hear her clearly. It is a fascinating exchange, Sioux Africa for MOVE. At any rate, the broadcast that we had today about Florida, I will just, again, I think it's worthy of mentioning Dr. Harry Moore, his wife, Harriet Moore, the explosion that happened in Florida, and again, which you can read about in The Warmth of Other Suns, the lovely Isabel Wilkerson. And then Dr. Marvin Dunn, he was on the program back in 2013. We talked about his book, The Beast in Florida, A History of Anti-Black Violence, which is a phenomenal read. I'm so glad that I read that book and that we had him on the program. I'm pretty sure Dr. Marvin Dunn would have some information on what happened with the Dozier School. He might be a great resource. If you are a black person and you live in Florida, you should have like all of the books that Dr. Marvin Dunn has written. I think almost all of them deal directly with racism, and the vast majority of them are focused on the history of Florida. So I would dare, that should be priority one. If you are a black person, you were born in Florida, you live there now, Dr. Marvin Dunn, The Beast in Florida. It is amazing. And she mentioned right in the program, Ms. Harrell, about needing to talk to our children about the lynching of Claude Neal. Dr. Marvin Dunn spends extensive time discussing the lynching of Claude Neal in Florida. But great information, and again, just in my view, the importance of putting all of this in a context so that you can understand why these things happen and what this means for our lives, August 9th, 2016. Folks have comments on what they heard this evening related to the Dozier School. Feel free. Anybody have anything that stood out significantly from Ms. Harrell, the Dozier School?
Can I be heard? Hey.
Yes, I heard both of you. We'll get the caller that spoke up first. Hang on 1 second. The person that spoke first, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Greetings to you, Gus, and to all the callers. I found tonight's program to be extremely constructive. I would love to have her back on the program. I think she said some of the most profound things that I've heard in a while, especially when she got to the discussion about her love of black men and her understanding of what we have gone through. I found that to be extremely touching. It made me really think about just when she discussed, just gave the scenario of a black male being at home and their daughter or wife or both being accosted and sexually assaulted and then dropped back off and you not being able to do anything about it. The way that it hit me is very similar, which is why I've always suggested a book title named Kabuka by Umalimu Baruti, because the way that he writes, he puts you in that same frame of mind too, where you're there experiencing what our ancestors were going through in some of these scenarios that played out. And I just found that that her ability to be in touch with that reality and even understanding the damage. So even, you know, when we do act in ways that are not necessarily positive towards one another, she even has an understanding of that, even though it's not condoned. And I just found that to be very profound. Also, I think what she talked about as far as the importance of our, like you just talked about not too long ago, the importance of us having these discussions with our children, with our family, it really makes me think, and I just want to thank you, Gus, for this show, because it helped to bring home for me how important this program is. And I can totally understand why when I first came into contact with it, I just had to get every episode, and just really, really it brings home just the bravery of the other people who call and give their ideas and their thoughts, because it helps to, it's a consciousness expanding experience, and it's also cathartic to be able to talk about things that are very uncomfortable and painful and get those things out in a form where you're not judged, which is what I love about the format of the show in regards to tolerating anti-blackness as far as the way that we discuss other black people. So I just wanted to say, too, thank you for this show, the platform. I think she really brought home the importance of the work that you're doing in having a platform for us to be able to speak to one another and really talk about things that are extremely important. And then also the idea that for us to spread this stuff, not just keep it to ourselves, but tell as many black people as would listen about these truths, so that we can shift the consciousness of our people towards wanting to really, really dismantle this system and replace it with a system of justice. And thanks again. I'll mute my line there.
Appreciate that. Appreciate that. Other caller that spoke up simultaneously with Roz, you were going to share?
Yeah, man. I want to bag what Roz said. I mean, I ain't catch the whole program. I'm going to listen tomorrow. But I did, that kind of touched me when she was talking about the black male, you know what I mean? So, yeah, that was kind of uplifting right there, because, hey, you know, I mean, I know all the black males on here could feel that, but the other thing I want to say, man, good. Sometimes I'll be wanting to, you know, if I don't make it in, I would like somebody to always ask me, like, when it's a black person on here, what is their opinion of what the solution would be? You know, because that's what I be wanting to hear. And because I don't think, I don't be hearing it from white people. I really don't even like white people being on here. Because, I mean, it ain't my show. I mean, I know. But it's like, it don't produce nothing. We see what's going on with these white people, just like that lady yesterday. But when we talk to black people, because I think the solution got to come from us. So, you know, but I don't know. I just sometimes I be wanting to hear what other people think, different opinions or whatever, or what the solution, the answer to what do you think will be our way out of this situation, you know, and see what some of our black guests and even some of the callers think about. What can we do? You know, and that's it, man. Thank you. Thank you for the program, too. I'm going to mute myself out.
Yes, sir. Anybody else have comments they want to make sure they got in, what they heard from Ms. Sorrell, the Dozier School?
Can I still be heard?
I heard both of you. Mr. Nero?
Yes, I thought I heard someone else also. If they want to go first, that's fine.
Go ahead, Mr. Nero.
Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I just thought that she really touched on how retarded our manhood is. You know, I just thought that spoke volumes. What we've had to endure and how that has retarded our manhood, how today, it, you know, just really explains the feminization of black males, the lack of being able to just to provide, protect, secure, and defend his family, you know, and the rape, which rarely gets discussed because it's different when a man is being raped. His body's not designed for that, you know. So, I mean, it's totally different because women don't lose their womanhood when she's raped. But a man feels as if he has lost his manhood when it happens to him. You know, I don't know if anything that can happen to a woman where she no longer says, I'm not a woman anymore, you know. But with a man, it's so many different things. If he can't provide, if he can't protect, if you can't secure, if you can't defend, your manhood is always on the chopping block. And so for me, that was the reason why I asked the question, because that's something I've been studying a lot recently and just seeing how retarded we are. You could put my name up at that list, just in the development of our manhood. And I'll mute my line.
I don't think anybody's body is designed for rape. I did just want to make sure I got that in. I don't think anybody's body is designed for rape. Go ahead, Thomas in New York.
I think Mr. Nero, said it very well about the manhood thing. She definitely laid that down well. I share a lot of sentiments with thank you for you having the show as well. This was a breath of fresh air, not as entertaining as yesterday, but definitely more informative. I had no idea this happened. I mean, I was looking and sort of like, oh, my God, you know, like, I just couldn't believe it. And, I mean, I could believe it, but it was just like, you know, just I was, like,
empathizing with people. You know, I'm putting myself in their shoes, and really, what can you do? You're in prison. You know, you're in a time where you may have no rights whatsoever. Like, not like today's any different. And then what stunned me was when the caller came in and was like, yeah, I was there in 1990. I'm like, oh, my God, like, this is still open after? I mean, this system is no joke. I mean, it's just, they are relentless, man. It's no redeeming for them. Everything that comes out everywhere, I mean, it just gets no worse. Everything that we worked with, you know, or talked about, it's just they just it gets deeper and deeper. I mean, we could just start digging. If we had to tell our story in this country, I mean, it'd be so many books of just terror. And I think she was right that we need to really face that, because I find that the hardest thing for me to get black people to accept the fact is simply that white people are superior. Oh, they'll fight you on that like it's crazy. Like, I'm like, go to court. Go try to get another job. Go. I mean, they have all the cards in their hands. I mean, total superiority. If we can't accept something as simple as that, I mean, I think that we really need to, maybe not with the slave movies. I think that has its own point, and look who's putting it out. But we do have to revisit that whole aspect of our experience here and deal with the fact that, yeah, we were powerless. We had no rights. We were shadow property. You know, it's just, you know, if we don't deal with that, we're never going to move forward. And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
That was it, Thomas in New York?
That was it.
Right on. Appreciate that as well. Anybody else that chimed in? The caller at 1-842. I don't think you got a question at all when Ms. Sorrell was with us. Caller at 1-842. Did you have a commentary?
Yes. Thank you very much for taking my call. Good evening, everybody. And I'll be short. I didn't actually have a question for her, and I did want to thank her, but everyone thanked her, and I knew she had to go. So, but I definitely do appreciate her work, and definitely did appreciate all that she said. And I don't think I heard too many females comment or call in for this one. But when she did talk, when she answered the question and said that it made her love black men more, I felt the same thing, not on this one, but I was listening to another broadcast, and I think that's when I learned about the book of white women raping black men, and I looked into that a little bit more. And at the moment, I'd like to assert that I think it's possible that part of the whole, like, feminist movement was to really kind of, like, brain trash non-white black women into forgetting or not acknowledging the rape of black men, or because it's not so much talked about or something like that, but to just completely put that to the side, because the truth is it really did happen. And I don't think that there's a difference between the rape of black men and the rape of black women, but I definitely understand that there's a different element to it, and I definitely think that it has something to do with the rise in perhaps homosexuality or just dysfunctional sexual behavior altogether between men and women, black men and women. But when I thought about that, the few podcasts that I listened to ago, I had that same feeling. And when she told me this, because I try to be online at the same time that someone's speaking, so if they say something, I can look it up. So I was looking at pictures and everything like that, and just the thought of it happening like at this school and then expanding it out to the hundreds of years that we were under their direct chattel slavery and direct, you know what I'm trying to say. Forgive me if I'm not being that articulate, but and what that meant for black women, but also black men and black boys, and what that means for how the men are, you know, not how the men are, but how the men feel today, and if they're even conscious of it all the time, how it plays out in all of our sexuality and our relationships and stuff like that. And I'm not a man, obviously. And so, you know, there's a lot about manhood I, as a female, don't necessarily understand. All I can place are my preconceived expectations or gendered norms that society tells me what it's supposed to be like. But from the basics of what I understand, I know that that kind of violation can tear at the foundation of what it would mean to be a man. And she mentioned something else, which I wanted, I really, my heart just went out when she said it, because she also tied in the economics about it. And, you know, there's like a movement, there's like a lot of Black women who kind of really seem anti-Black male. And like, you can see them in social media and stuff like that. And always talking about, you know, Black women having to work really hard and a Black man not doing this and just kind of perpetuating these stereotypes. But when I meet Black men and, you know, we really start talking about, you know, how difficult it is to get employment and all that kind of stuff. In addition to, I work in a corporate environment, my observations in that corporate environment, number one, there are not a lot of Black men in there. And I don't think it's that, I know it's not that we're not smart enough, they're not smart enough or desirous enough or whatever. But given the dynamics of the system and what you have to do in those environments, I myself as a Black woman have to do quite a bit of contorting and shape-shifting just to keep my job, right? So I can only, and what that feels like with white men, I can only imagine what that feels like for Black men. And I'll just say this too, like I noticed, I've been paying attention to how white men are responding to who, like the so-called attractive Black men. Like, I can't make a blanket statement, but I really do feel that overall that the white male is a homosexual and they really are predators on Black men. I've been able to watch like a few and I'm like, how do y'all feel about this? You know, and they try to, you know, try to thinking that I might judge them as a homophobe. I'm like, no, you can be open with me. Like, how do you really feel about this? Cause they're like pretty much undressing them with their eyes and, you know, all this kind of just disrespectful behavior. And so I can only imagine what it must have been like for when a white male would get his hands on a Black male and what he would do. And so I really appreciated her saying that it does, when you really think about it, it really kind of, as a Black woman who, you know, there's all this propaganda, Black women, Black female power and strength and all this kind of stuff and all these subliminal messages to separate you from Black men and make you feel like they're not whatever, whatever, to really put it in a perspective and be like, yeah, I suffered. Of course I did. You know what I mean? The children have suffered and the men have suffered in a very sadistic sexual fashion. That, like, I always talk about, if a woman is raped and has had a trauma, right, and she's pregnant, it's possible for her to pass that, like, PTSD onto the child. Like, studies show that that's possible, even if she's not pregnant at the time. Just the trauma and the stress in her will transfer to the child. I can only imagine what that does to the father who then might have a son or just how he relates to anybody, or the male who just relates to anybody, relates to his woman, relates to his body, to his parts and all that kind of stuff. So it really did in me when she said it. I felt the same thing that she was saying, that it does make you love Black men in a new way and be okay and, you know, kind of make sure you keep in your eye, your main eye. Like, there really is a war on all of us, and this is a dynamic on Black men. It ain't just, like, Black women, and Black women struggle is not above Black men struggle and all that kind of craziness they keep trying to put in our face. And the economics is definitely a part of it. There's definitely a money war on all of us, and definitely Black men. They always love to talk about how unemployed, but that's by design. So I really appreciated this one. This one took away my appetite. It just messed up my night, but I do appreciate it. So thanks, guys. And thank you for taking my call. I'll mute myself now.
For sure. The caller in Ohio, did you have commentary you wanted to add as well? I don't think we heard from you either.
Yes. Hi to Gus, the host, and to all the callers and stuff. I just really wanted to call in and just say thank you for this show. You know, my master's is in history, and when I read, I haven't gotten nowhere near as deep as what this woman has discovered. But daily, or the more this stuff is brought out, we just we just don't have, I always say, we just don't have a clue as to what really has happened to, you know, like we say, our ancestors, and from the period of time that she was talking to these, I mean, some of these people are still alive. So these are people's great-grandfathers, or to the, you know, great-grandfathers, grandfathers, maybe people's fathers. So this is our time, you know. And just to hear the passion in her voice, and, you know, and so I just want to even thank her for what she did. And I also want to thank her for what she spoke about black men, and, like, her love for black men and, you know, understanding and seeing what they went through. And, you know, a couple of things in my mouth. I just know yesterday I was on a Facebook post, and the guy, he says something like, well, you know, black men are carrying this by themselves. And I said, no, you know, and I told him, I said, I'm not even saying that, you know, black women are carrying it by themselves. My thing is that, you know, we're both trying to carry this thing, and, you know, this, it just crushes us. And so I just told him, he said something, and I said, but, you know, I said, we need to be studying white men to understand white people, to understand what's going on with us. So, you know, he come back, and he was asking me for some examples. And so I was just explaining to him the things that I see in the system. You know, we don't know, like you said, the level of rape. It was painful to hear, like, she spoke about the one man who had been raped, and then she said something about the wife suspected something, and, you know, finally, I guess, you know, he lets her know. And it's that you're married to a man that you love, and the pain is so deep, that, and the humiliation is so deep that you don't even want to confide this into the woman that you're married to, the woman that will give birth to your children. I mean, it's just that deep. And I mean, you know, it's not because I take it, you know, thank God I've never been raped, and I'm just quite sure that women would be the same thing. It's just things that not that we talk to, but I understand that men, it would probably be just even worse. I just think these people are sick, but Thomas of New York said something, and it made me think of something. He was saying, like, sometimes to try to convince black people of things that go on, like she was saying, we need to, you know, talk to these people. We need to stop hiding this. Part of these slave movies, 12 Years a Slave, and the Django, where it's not slavery, but here where necessity is, the Django, and, you know, Birth of the Nation is coming out. This stuff is written from the white people's point of view. She made a good point when she says that you change the language and you talk about the importance of language instead of just saying that, oh my God, they beat them. This, oh no, you just got a spanking. When that person was beaten, and we know that a beating compared to a spanking, there's just really no comparison, you know. And so you start, the language is softened to make these people, like she said, to think that they are superior. A people really, as Dr. Laina Africa say, the animal that we call people really should be up under our feet. And so to do this stuff, to change it, to make them look good. Oh, no, you know, so slavery wasn't that bad. But I'll say this without losing my mind. I think the hardest part for me is to convince black people today that a lot of what goes on with us stems from slavery. And I've had people say to me, that was back then, this is now. And what happened, you know, and you know, because it's like people think you go from slavery to today, and it's like, no, this comes down, you know, because like she said, slavery is, we've only been what, maybe out of shadow, or you know, chattel slavery 100-something years, but, you know, up until 1965, you know, there was still stuff going on. So we've only really, in a sense, been out of slavery, what, 50 years, 51 years? And people were still, black people, just like, that doesn't affect us. And it's just like, it does affect us. So I just really want to thank you for the show. And I'm just going to say this as I mute myself, because it was a great relief after last night. Anyway, thank you, and I'll mute myself.
Right on. See, I think we got everybody that dialed in who we had not heard from at all. So if you had a comment you wanted to make sure you got in, and we haven't heard from you at all, you should get your hand up now. We're not doing the chime in, slide in at the last minute if you have a comment that you want to make. Anybody else have anything they wanted to get in, a comment, something that stood out?
Hey, Gus, can I ask one more question, man?
Yes, sir.
Look, now, what that lady from Ohio just said, right, and you know what? Because, see, that made me feel kind of like a rape victim. Like, I wasn't physically raped, but, I mean, we talking about, you know, the effects of slavery and the and just to be and to take somebody body, that's like one of the worstest things. That got to be the most harshest thing probably on the planet, right? But is it safe to say that shoot, we really are all rape victims? You know, it didn't trickle down just like slavery. When you say slavery is affecting us in the way that we behave today. You know what I mean? It's kind of like we all rape victims. You know, and that's all I wanted to say. Well, I mean, when she spoke on that, because that is the hardest thing to convince people that we are part of a slavery. And we say, well, oh, slavery was hundreds of years ago, and, you know, this a new day. We all, you got, it's different. You got plenty of opportunities they ain't have. But it's something, and the other caller that said, he was saying something, but you know, about how silly or something black men have become, because we don't defend our families. We don't even defend ourselves against white people. Now, how in the world do a person don't even defend it? Man, white people did something to us, man. I don't know, man. I'm going to mute my line, man. Thanks, y'all, man. I appreciate all y'all, man.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
One thing I wrote down, I forget who she said it, but she said, "Damn it, they're demons in the form of human beings." I don't know if she was quoting somebody else, but I've been giving that some thought for a really, really long time. And I feel like maybe one of the things is we really struggle. I think the ultimate question that a lot of us get to that I think we have a block on is, what if they really are just evil? Someone posed a question about their pathology. Like, what if that really is their pathology, their psychology, and not just like a few of them, but just inherent within them? And since, the word is escaping me. I don't want to say delusion, but deception, excuse me. Since deception is their master art, like that's their tool of choice, like essence to them, it's quite possible for them to, and I was talking about it a little earlier with someone, so maybe we shouldn't have been considering a double consciousness that we have, but perhaps it is they too who have a double conscious, like one, like a front face, you know, and then deep lurking behind, you know, underneath their skin is like a demon within that, with given the proper trigger or the proper environment or situation, would just be unleashed upon the world yet again. But since it's been able to control the environment and get appeased in whatever way, being pretty much placated to or given whatever it wants, then it's cool since it feels like it's in control. But should it ever feel like it is no longer in control, then I guess it would rear its demon face. But I think when a lot of people say, well, what is it just about white people? And sometimes it's like, it's just hard to even, for some people to even formulate the question, what if this is just who they are, like who and what they are, inherent to their psychology, inherent to their pathology. But I just wanted to say that. So thank you.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so I just want to make a comment. And, you know, I might be wrong, but I think, Gus, you've proven time and time again that, you know, white people, from the shows you've done, that white people are not ignorant, none of them. And what it means to be white is to be a racist. I think that's pretty clear from your body of work. Mr. Fuller says, black men do not qualify to be men under the system of racism, white supremacy, that we are boys.
So when I see a white man, I don't think white people's culture is homosexuality. I think it's pedophilia. When I see a white man with a black man and they're in this homosexual relationship, I look at it like that. If that white man is not ignorant, he knows that that's a boy and it's and under the system. And he's really a pedophile. He's with a boy. You know, he's not with a man. He's not looking to be with a man. If he's looking to be with a man, he'll be with a white man. He's with someone he can control and dominate like a boy. And I think that their true essence, if you study them, it's not homosexuality, it's pedophilia. And that's what their ultimate goal is coming up. Is that's the next thing they're trying to legalize, is pedophilia. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Jerry Sandusky. In fact, you can include, if I want to give my plug to discourage black participation in athletics until this problem is solved, sending your child to be the next LeBron James, Carmelo Anthony, Kobe Bryant, or you pick any sport that you like, Cam Newton, if it's football, or the next Serena Williams, the next Venus Williams, pick your sport, Gabrielle Douglas, pick your sport. You likely will be sending them to the next Jerry Sandusky, the next Donald Sterling. And I say that not because of the audio recording. I say that because of years before it got to that, it was reported that Donald Sterling was in the Clipper locking room looking at the black basketball players on the team he owned and saying, oh, look at these black bodies, watching them while they were nude and showering. That did not become a big deal. He didn't get fired. Nobody was, you know, talking incessantly about Donald Sterling when that was reported. And this was, you know, pretty mainstream stuff at the time. It didn't, until the audio came out, then it became a big deal to talk about Donald Sterling being a racist. But these are likely the types of folks that you will be sending your child off to in search of, you know, that NBA contract or whatever it is. So just keep that in mind as well. And the importance, again, talking to your children about racism and talking to your children about sexual abuse. I think we've done quite a few programs talking about the intersection of those two repeatedly over the years. It unfortunately goes hand in hand very frequently. Folks that have a predilection for raping children, the most vulnerable children on the planet are black children. Easy pickings. Any other folks have commentary?
Just a tidbit. Today I delivered a piece of mail to someone's desk, and it was from NAMBA, that National Association of Man Boy Love, or whatever. It's that association. So I'm already looking at him kind of sideways now. So it's real. Like, they have associations trying to legalize pedophilia. I mean, this is what their agenda is.
This incident, I cannot leave out the incident in Idaho at the Dietrich School, where the disabled black male student, he was on the football team, again, discouraging athletics along the way. Formal participation in formal athletics, that's more what I'm talking about. But yeah, the disabled black male student, where he was bullied, terrorized, and raped. This was apparently encouraged by the white staff at this high school, but all of that just came out over the last few months, and they charged one of the little white terrorists, rapists, in all of this. Apparently he was raped, and they sodomized him with a coat hanger, but they had done a lot of this stuff for months and months and months, and nothing was done about it. Just another reason, very important. Talk to your children about racism, white supremacy, and just honestly, we have enemies. Those enemies are white. That needs to be pointed out clearly in no uncertain terms to our children. In my view, I could be wrong. Anybody else have anything else they want to make sure they got in?
Yes. I wanted to piggyback off of what Thomas in New York said. One thing I've learned, because I've been studying, too, a lot of white people's fascination with bestiality, and I do not look at white people with pets the same. It's transformed my entire understanding of white people and pets. And then working in the healthcare industry, I've come across some of the most disgusting cases of disease
And I mean, when I say disease, I mean stuff that I can't even say the names of these illnesses, and they're STDs, and it's white people that have these things. And I kid you not, I will just implore anyone to do not ever have sexual contact with them, because the things you can contract is just, I can't even put it into words. And this is stuff that I deal with every single day. So I've been there for a little over a year. So I really understand what I'm looking at. And it's just like Dr. Welsing said, look at what they call themselves, germ man. And that's all I will say. Thank you. And I'll mute my line.
Everybody good? Any final comment before we wrap? Or are folks satisfied?
Do you have a date for the Sioux Africa rehash?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. It'll probably be sometime the early part of next week. We already have programs, except for tomorrow, we have programs for three consecutive days. So I'm thinking probably the early part of next week. That'll give me time to get my sound clips together and all of that to... Plus, if there are any repercussions, if I get any emails between now and then about being working for the fuzz, then I can include that in the telecast. So probably sometime the early portion of next week. Folks want to be prepared.
Oh, yeah, Gus, I had a question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Are you planning to do a program in memoriam of Dr. Sabi at all, or is that something that you were thinking about or contemplating possibly?
I don't feel the best equipped on that. Like, he hadn't been a guest on the Cows, and I didn't know him personally. He wasn't someone I had followed as well, so I don't feel as qualified to be able to, you know, give proper tribute. I feel like there are probably folks that are better qualified, who know his teachings better, and know some of the folks who are more knowledgeable about his contributions and, you know, how he would want folks to remember and appreciate what he did with his time and energy, his existence on the physical plane, who are better qualified at that than myself. So I hadn't necessarily planned a tribute per se, a program per se, to dedicate to Dr. Sebi.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. As I find stuff, I will pass it along. People had been messaging me outside the country. I just shared same thing we kind of discussed this past weekend and some of the updates that you all had, just trying to get more clarity about it. As I come across things, I will share. Folks satisfied? Everyone satisfied?
Can I say one thing? Last thing, I should say.
Yes, sir.
All right. And this was just, actually yesterday I saw a lecture of Dr. Sabi's, and in the lecture he said that he doesn't worship anyone but his mother, and that God is his mother. And like I said, growing up from a very young age, I used to hear Dr. Ben always say the black woman is God, and then multiple occasions that he worshiped his wife. And I just wanted to throw that out there, that they were in tune as far as their understanding of who and what the black woman was and should be to us as black people. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We will wrap there. If folks have questions, if you can't find something in the archives or other information that you want to make sure you communicate, feel free to drop us an email. UntilJustice@gmail.com. UntilJustice@gmail.com. On Twitter, @UntilJustice. @UntilJustice. You can catch us on Twitter. Updates for the program, you'll see the events posted on the Facebook pages, plural, but the events, when we have upcoming programs, they are posted there at least a day in advance, sometimes earlier. Just check there, and again, you can always drop an email if you have confusion about program times or guest suggestions, gripes, complaints, whatever the case may be. If folks are looking for, I won't say constructive viewing material, it's not the most entertaining film in the world, or it's actually a television show, but it's called Vice Principals. One of our listeners recommended it. He thought I should check it out. And I would read. That was how I read the book for today's program. I would read. I would try and get like bigger chunks. So I'd read like 30, 40 pages, and then I'd stop, take a little break, and then read some more chunks. And so I would take a little break and watch a segment of this television show. You do not need to watch the whole thing. It comes on HBO, Vice Principals. It's a new show. I think they only have 4 episodes. I didn't watch all 4. You only need to see the second episode in the series to get an adequate idea of what this show is about, what it reveals about racism, white supremacy. The second episode, it's only been out, this just came out a few weeks ago, and they've done 4 episodes. But the basic plot of the show is you have these two white men. They're the main characters, and they are very homoerotic in their behavior. One of them is married to a non-white female, cowbell, but if you watch it, the homosexuality is rampant in their behavior. Anyway, the whole premise of the show is these two white males are upset because there's a black female principal, and they're upset that she's the principal, so they're working together to try to get her fired. And they share within the context of the show that they don't like each other, right? We're not friends. We don't get along. We're not homies. None of that. Our only bond, the only thing that is tying us together, is that we don't like this black female and we want to get her fired. That's why they're working together. And in the second episode in the series, which is called A Trusty Steed, that's the name of episode 2. The second episode, they vandalize, steal from, and burn down the house of this black female. And this, again, is their bonding experience. They make it really long and outrageous because they, like, vandalize the property first, and they're breaking up her furniture and all of this. And when they get done with all of that, then they just decide that they need to burn the whole house to the ground. And it, amazing illustration of white supremacy. You don't need to watch the whole series, and it's only 30 minutes, so you don't need to watch the whole series or anything like that. I'm not continuing. I just, episode 2, that's the only one you need to watch. It'll give you a lot in terms of understanding. This plays right to workplace racism, which is our next program Thursday, 8 p.m. Eastern. But this is what we're dealing with on the job. And as I've stated before, practicing white supremacy, terrorizing black people, is supposed to be fun. This is like a comedy. That's how they present this. And they even call it a quote-unquote dark comedy about these white people deliberately burning down this black female's residence. And, I mean, the layers of racism are so deep. This black female has children. It reminds me of Monsters Ball, which you'll see depicted in this sitcom, and how she relates to her children. They're both black males. She has two black boys. And fussing, smacking them, yelling at them. It totally reminds me of Monsters Ball for people who saw the way that Halle Berry interacted with her black child before he was killed in that movie. It's very reminiscent. But after their house is burned down, the black female is blaming her black males. It's like for a time, she is suspecting that they burned the house down. And they're like, why would we burn our own house down, Mom? And it just goes back and forth. And she still thinks that they did it for a while. It is incredible. And even with them, they rob the house. They make it clear, because it pops up so frequently, that this is about money, that this is really about class, that, yeah, they do a lot of racism, but money is the bottom line. They make that clear in all of the antics and all these different missions. Their business operation of terrorizing this black female so that she gets fired and or quits her job. They say, oh, by the way, before we burned down this black female's house, I robbed her. I took some of her jewelry. You're entitled to have. We're going to split the booty, if you will. And the white guy's like, what? I don't know. And he says, yeah, you know, we burned it down. You know, at least we should get, you know, a few nickels out of all of this. And I thought, even within that, revealing the money is really secondary. Like, oh, yeah, by the way, you know, we might get a few hundred. This white man, one of the racists involved in all of this, he has pressing financial needs. Like, he has some debts that he needs to pay off. So it's not like he's in a position where he could benefit from having some extra financial resources. That's not the primary driving factor in all of this. The primary motive is terrorize this black female. Let's get her out of here. We want to see her fail. And so they rob her and pawn her jewelry. It is amazing, absolutely amazing illustration. Again, you only need to watch this one episode. Reading is way more important. Books like what we read today, Dark Days of Horror at Dozier, Rapes, Murders, Beatings, and Slavery. This is way more important than anything that you're going to find on the litany of channels. But again, this one episode, it does reveal quite a bit about racism, white supremacy, and you can think about this in the context of the job and being at work. Amazing. Check it out. If you have any thoughts, feel free to share. I might, because it is workplace racism, but that literally is the plot of this television show. These two white men working to make this black female lose her job. I might even take a chunk of it to lead us in for workplace racism this Thursday. But check it out if you're so inclined. If you need help finding a link, I might be able to help with that also. Anywho, we'll be back Thursday. Workplace racism. Feel free to chime in if you have experiences, codifications, suggestions. Looking forward to hearing from folks 48 hours from now, 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Pacific. For the folks who are interested in hearing from Pastor Gaddy, he was one of the victims that we heard about at Dozier. His book is on my wish list, so I guess we will go as fast as the book arrives. I already got his contact information. Miss Harrell hooked me up like almost immediately when she was off the line. She got me his number, so we will proceed, I guess, whenever I have the book in hand. We will make it happen with Mr. Gaddy, as long as he's willing to come and speak with us. But thanks to all the folks who contributed, great questions, great commentary, and hopefully solid information. I know we do have had for years a lot of great listeners in the Florida area. You should have this book, Dark Days of Horror at Dozier. You should get Pastor Gaddy's book. I would also encourage getting Dr. Marvin Dunn, his books, certainly The Beast in Florida. Lots of great information. Just really be knowledgeable about the history of white supremacy and what black people have had to endure in an area. If you were born there or if you reside there, really be knowledgeable. That could be a great way to teach your children and other people that you care about racism, white supremacy, what it means to be white. Thanks all. This is listener-supported counter-racist racism. The blog again, racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener-supported counter-racist radio. PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not in the PayPal, drop us an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. That said, I will again encourage sobriety would be best. I know it's summertime. Before you frolic and do all that, do not lax in being vigilant, codified. The system does not take breaks for us to have summer fun. If you're going to be in a vehicle, buckle up every single time, and you certainly do not want to be under the influence of anything. That goes if you are the driver, passenger, even if you are a pedestrian. You never know when it will be Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, who is the person pulling you over, putting your life in jeopardy, or at minimum, even just causing you a lot of easily avoidable problems. Let's be sober every time we're behind the wheel. Buckle up every time. Let's try to minimize contact with race soldiers, whites with or without a badge in general. Thanks again, Creator. We ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.